Good evening and welcome to the Wednesday, September 26th meeting of the Public Works Advisory Board. We have a full quorum this evening. Are there any members of the public that would like to make a comment at this time on items that are not on the agenda? Seeing no one at the podium, we'll continue on to the consent calendar. Approval of the minutes of August 15th. Are there any additions or corrections for the minutes of August 15th?
I recommend we move to approve the minutes as stated.
It's been moved. Is there a second?
Second.
Jan seconded it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carries. Business item two, or item two, the director's report. We'll let Rob handle this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, we have a report from all the Public Works divisions. I'm here. Want to point out, well, first, we can bring a new Public Works employee to the podium and make an introduction. He has his prepared statement, I see. this is Herb Edwards. He's a new assistant engineer in our Public Works Department. Even though I said new engineer, he's has quite a bit of experience in engineering, has come to us from the private sector and some time in the public sector in Arizona. So welcome aboard, Herb, and if you want to make any remarks, feel free to do so at this time.
This is your last chance.
You can never say anything ever again.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been in California for the last 4 years, moved from Prescott, Arizona, and very happy to have this opportunity to serve the public and the city of Morro Bay. Thank you very much.
I was just going to ask, you said assistant engineer, what division is he in?
Engineering.
Oh, well, overall, I mean, or capital projects?
A little bit of everything.
Oh, okay. Good deal. Thank you.
What's the temperature in Prescott?
I'm assuming 60 to 70 today. I haven't checked.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
I do have so a little bit of everything. And is Herb going to be involved with helping Pam get up to speed too?
Yes, he'll be involved in, working on our development projects, pavement management, reviewing traffic control plans. Providing probably hopefully a little bit of mentoring too, so as she proceeds forward in her career.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome aboard, Herb.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Our consolidated maintenance staff has been busy gearing up for pavement coatings coming back into town this fall to do some of their sealing projects we're going to do again this year, chip seal, cape seals, and microsurfacing along with the triple layer product that we've used in the past. There's a picture of Little Morro Creek Road that'll be triple layered up to the bike park and then cape sealed from the bike park to that last driveway in the city limits this year. Previous meetings, we've gone over the list. We'll update you probably next meeting on their, we expect them to be probably into town towards the end of October to do the work.
Rob, I got a quick question. After you go after, it's the BMX bike park you're talking about.
Yes.
How far out does the city limits go beyond that?
Quite a ways, actually.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
If you were to project Ironwood Avenue across the valley, it goes out to there. There's a so if you're driving
approximately like a mile, maybe
maybe about a mile. So if you hit that hairpin, that first hairpin, as you're going out Little Morro Creek, and then there's a turn a left-hand turn that goes to the northeast, almost a 90-degree. That's about where the city limits is.
And that's where you'll carry the Cape Seal?
No, we won't go out that far with it. There's a section of road out there that has been built with cold patch. We don't want a Cape Seal over coal patch. We need to do some a little bit of reconstruction work there.
Sure. Thank you.
And I had a comment. During my walk today, I walked down Capri. You might want to have that one kind of looked at. I don't think it's going to last 2 years before it dissolves.
Okay. We've done some work in the cloisters with some vegetated clearing. We have an example of a very colorful pie chart in the report that shows the amount of activities in our consolidated maintenance. We're still working on how to get that report out for our utilities divisions. It's not coming out. It's just as colorful, but the lines cross each other, and it's truncating text. So we're still working on ways to best report out the activities that we are logging into CityWorks.
I personally like tables and numbers, but I find pie charts not very, they don't help me.
Activity at the treatment plant, including roof replacement at the Elena booster pump, some tank maintenance, and we have two new staff members. We didn't bring them tonight in our utilities division. Paul and Grant have started. They've been there 2 weeks, Joe?
3 weeks.
3 weeks.
Are they on the? They're on the water side, correct? Yeah. Were they additions or were they replacements?
Replacements.
Oh, okay. Hi, Joe.
I'm just preparing in case you have more questions.
In our engineering capital projects, really no major changes in the status of our projects, with the exception of our big wastewater project. Since the last meeting, the environmental document was certified. We've completed the Prop 218 process. We have made application for the WIFIA loan. Last night, council authorized the staff to apply for the state revolving fund loan and authorized a contract with GSI for follow-on hydrogeological work to right-size the injection facilities in the Moro Valley, including well placement, well design, and the amount of water that ultimately can be injected and recovered into the Moro Valley. And
so
then
you're talking the IPR system.
Yes, the indirect potable reuse system.
Thank you.
So we needed some follow-on hydrogeotechnical work to complete that phase. Ideally, we would have issued that contract a few months ago, but with all the work effort going on regarding the Prop 218, that had the higher priority. I'll pause if there's any questions on the work project.
I've got several, so you may want to wait till.
Okay. And then in the end of the report, we've provided her a copy of our consumer confidence report that details out the water quality of water that we're providing to our Moro Bay customers. That concludes my summary, and now we can go to the inquisition.
Okay.
Or question, sorry.
And I'll let John the Inquisitor start.
All right. Let's see. Now, where should I?
And give us page numbers as you make, if you make reference.
I'd like to see an item added to your director's report of traffic safety. Just, you know, what items you do in order to maintain traffic safety. And it could be nothing some months, but when you actually do something, it'd probably be a good thing to tell people about.
Sure.
And along that traffic safety thing, can we move that fence at Morrow Mist to the back of the sidewalk and start using it? I know there's a couple gaps there where the utility pole has been taken out, but they could throw in some base rock in there so if it's not a tripping hazard, and the other one is they've got to put in a curb drain from the looks of it.
Yeah, they can either throw some a plate and chamfer with cold patch or put in base material.
Yeah, but it'd be really nice to allow that sidewalk to be used rather than putting the school kids out on the street. So, you catch that?
Yeah.
You got my like.
And we'll get trap.
Did the resolution 7818 get approved at council yesterday? That's the adopt trolley vehicle purchase.
Yes.
And
then we had a future agenda item to bring back about the disposition of the trolley that we're going to surplus. The mayor brought up the idea of using it as a mobile visitor center. So we may keep it around, but it may be purchased by the one of the other city funds.
Okay. Let's see. City works work orders. So you're called tailored, but you mean you're just editing whatever it is so it reads the way you want it to read. Is that right?
Yes.
Where is lift station 2?
That's on the Embarcadero.
Is that at the Triangle parking lot?
At the bottom of the Surf Street stairs. That's lift station 2.
This is on page 10 for those that are following.
Farther on down, you got performed routine lift station maintenance. Was that on which lift station was that?
That was on all three of them.
Okay.
You know, it just came up for quarterly, our routine maintenance. Quarterly, we go out and we pull the pumps and derag them.
So all the lift stations got.
Yeah, so lift station 1, we have 3 lift stations. Lift station 1 is at the open area in the Cloisters development. Lift station 2 is at the bottom of the Surf Street stairs. Lift station 3 is at the intersection of Quintana and South Bay Boulevard.
Okay, cool. So you're teaching your people. Is this a trenchless boring? The hydro excavation equipment, is that trenchless boring?
That is.
Okay. Let's see. I was looking at the operation and maintenance. Has anyone done an analysis of what maintenance items, which you typically report here, won't be needed once the wharf is in place? Or is it just going to be a reduction of how often it happens?
Well, depending on what area you're looking at, if you're actually looking at the wastewater treatment.
It says wastewater treatment, yeah.
Yeah, so all those actually will no longer be done because that plant will be shut down and the maintenance and operations activity will take place at the new wharf.
Do you expect maintenance activities to be reduced with the new facility?
No, I don't, actually. I expect the routine maintenance actually to increase because there's a lot more mechanical equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot more routine maintenance that you actually have to do, you know, oil changes, filter changes and stuff. There's more mechanical equipment that requires attention.
But there will be less worn out.
There'll be less corrective work orders. There will be more preventative where we're actually just maintaining that type of equipment.
All right. Let's see. I was looking at the stormwater resource plan. I'm not sure. I had a few comments on when I went online and took a look at it. Is who's reviewing the the primary reviewer for the city of that resource plan to make sure everything is. Is that you, Damaris?
Yes, I work with them. Yeah.
And then
it's up for public comment right now too. So
yeah, that's why I got like four comments or four or five things which popped up. And maybe let me go over these things with you. Are there going to be any limitations to Morro Bay's water supply? I was looking at page 1-14 of that report.
No, I mean, so this report really, Morro Bay's part of it is it's a requirement now. If you want to apply for grants, you have to have a stormwater resources plan. So that's more of a watershed plan compared to the plan we have. And then it's a way that you can put projects in there. If you have a project you want to go for grant funding, you can put that in there, and it's got, you know, it kind of ranks them and prioritizes everyone's that puts it in there. It's the basis of the whole plan.
So basically it's a mechanism to get funding for projects.
Yes.
So essentially it's not going to affect the Morro Bay water supply. There won't be any restrictions.
No,
okay.
No, it's
figure 111. Project list. Do we have a project list for Morro Bay, which is in there?
Yes, we have several projects in there.
Do you think you could
One of them is the boat wash area. Kind of infiltrating that water and treating it before it goes into the bay. Another one is the cloisters area and kind of using the area between the pond and the highway, mm-hmm. and using that kind of for the same reasons. And the other project is escaping me right now. It might be a Green Streets project.
What's a Green Street?
On Greenwood, it takes the water and infiltrates it in certain areas and stuff. Has like bioswales on the side of it.
Okay. And is there any chance that these projects will receive much funding, or is it?
Well, we actually just applied for a grant for the boat wash area.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we got it. We actually had to group it with a couple other projects, it was part of a parks grant, actually. So basically these would go in with the earworm plans and throughout the whole county, and then whenever you have grant funding that you want to go for, you pull them out of there and apply.
Kind of like
them,
that street, the local street thing the county does where certain projects are picked for funding. Is that the same sort of process? Is the county going to be selecting, or who selects the projects?
The projects, any project can get put in there, and then it just gets ranked in there. But if it's ranked high or low, it doesn't matter. You can still put your project in there. You just can't apply for Prop 1 grant funding if your project's not in there.
Okay. Morro Mist, I talked about sidewalk. New Wharf. So I was at the candidates forum a couple nights ago, and there was a comment by Jeff to the fact that 1,000 ballots were not counted. Do you know what that was about?
So there were, at the public hearing, a couple individuals brought up 1,000 ballots and said that they were collected prior to the release of the rate study and the advertisement of the proposed rate surcharge, based on a resolution that the city adopted prior to starting the 218 process,
mm-hmm.
That made those ballots invalid. So the council followed their own resolution that they had passed and did not count those ballots.
Is that what the Howard Jarvis Foundation is going to be looking at? Or?
They'll probably be looking at a lot of things.
Okay. And then the last question I have is, so we got the WIFIA loan, which we've got, that's worth about $20 million in reduced carrying costs. And what about the SRF loan? If we get that, how much does that reduce the carrying costs for the WIRF?
It reduces the rate by $7 a month, so it goes from 41 to 34.
So how many millions of dollars does that translate to?
22 million, wasn't it, is what the SRF is worth? We're going to look that up while some other questions come up.
It says in here it wasn't approved yet. Is that
correct? No, SRF, we have not completed.
No, the WIFIA loan.
No, it's not approved yet. That is correct. We've made application.
Right.
They've indicated that as long as we have a complete application and meet all the requirements, the funding is available. So
it's not a slam.
It's not a slam dunk. It's about as close as you can get, though.
And what's the timeline on that?
They will not fund until we show the project fully funded. So they could fund it at any time, but we just need to show that we have the other 51% of funding available.
So you have a high confidence level that if we bring up all the other funding,
then it's going to be funded, yes, because they accepted the proposals for the amount of money that they had in that first round.
Okay. I'd like to, while you're on that, I'd like to ask if the people that are challenging the 218 vote, is it similar to an election that if they want to challenge, then they have to, I mean, they have the opportunity to challenge and have the votes validated, but they would have to pay for it if they don't succeed?
The Prop 218 process for rates is not an election, so we don't follow the election rules.
Okay.
So there is no council decision has come and gone.
So it would be a court issue?
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm not going to speculate on what's going to happen.
Of course not. Yeah. Sue.
Okay. Question on operation and maintenance. We got respond to four after our call outs for plant chlorine. How do we get the calls out? Do they come Wi-Fi to you, or does the system call you, or do you call it, or what happens with that, Joe?
No, the actual system calls us. It's through a computerized auto dialer, but it is through the phone line, and then the on-call operator carries a cell phone.
Okay, so anything that happens there is logged in automatically, so you can see what the history is and so on with that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we track the chlorine continuously, and then we have a high and a low where it alarms out. And we actually have those alarms set well before any of the violations could potentially occur. So we're well within our safe realms on those.
Okay, you've got a note here that says replace scum and sludge pump run time clocks. Time clocks, are they digital time clocks, or are they click?
They're just like the old sprinkler time clocks with little pins. You know, it's still old school down there. So you just basically put the number of pins on for the number of minutes that you want that sludge pump to run.
And
they were just wore out. So relatively cheap items. I think the time clocks were, you know, $50, maybe $75 a piece. Relatively cheap.
Okay. Do they typically fail once a year, twice a year?
No, the ones that were in there were probably in there somewhere around the 5 to 7 year time frame. You know, they are they're still industrial time clocks. They're in metal cases, but the corrosion and the salt air in this area really do take its toll on them.
Okay. What are sparge or tubes, if I'm pronouncing it right?
Yeah, so that's in one of our digesters. So what they allow is they actually allow for a mixing of the sludge by the gas itself that's being produced. So as the sludge in that digester decomposes, it actually rises up. The gas is lighter than the sludge material. So the sparger tubes actually inject that gas back down underneath to the bottom of the digester, and as it rises back up through that sludge, it mixes that the components of that unit.
Okay. What's a grit chamber?
So the grit chamber is the picture that we actually have on there. So that's one of the first areas that the the inflow and flows actually come to. With this being a lot of sandy soils in this area, the sewer lines do collect a lot of sand and grit coming into the system. So what we do is we actually bring it into that chamber, aerate it, the heavier grit and sand settles to the bottom, and we're able to remove it at that time instead of pushing that grit and sand through all our pumps and wearing them out.
Is that a hazardous waste that you have to haul off someplace?
It is. It does get hauled off to the landfill.
What's going on with Sonic? I thought that was approved and going. I'm ready to eat hamburgers.
The Planning Commission did approve the project. It's they're going through plan check right now, and we're waiting for them to resubmit.
Cut the loan cut. That's all I have.
Chris?
I was just going to ask a quick question on the pavement management. You mentioned that the streets have been, the list has been sent off to Pavement Coatings for updated prices and scheduling. What is kind of the foreseen scheduling of that?
I would anticipate something near what we did last year. So I think they started the grinding of pavement markings Halloween, where they ground off the wrong pavement markings at San Jacinto and had to come back and redo those. But near the end of October, it's probably about a three-week total job here in Morro Bay. We're one of their smaller clients, so we don't get the highest priority on the list. We're not doing millions of dollars of work.
Okay, Christian?
Yeah, just a couple small questions. One said that in the digester area, you noticed that there was a leak coming up through the concrete. So I just was questioning, is that under pressure and there's any regulation on the line, or we just noticed it after it bubbled up through the concrete?
Yeah, that actually was a potable water line. So I should have noted that in the report. So, yeah, we just we noted that a potable water line was leaking that we used for washdowns in that area.
And I know we're going to do the water stuff, but on the WIFIA loan, so just in the overall plan right now, if let's say the project's $120 million, what type of outsourced lending are we looking for? I mean, what, you know, 90% of that are we in, or what's the target for the project overall?
So the maximum on the WIFIA loan is 49% of the project costs. We have some cash. And then we have an existing $10.7 million planning and design loan from SRF, which is at 1.7% interest. So we'll be using that cash, hopefully SRF first, as our first sources of money, and using WIFIA last, because that's the highest interest rate. Okay. So you want to use the low interest rate money first and then go to the high. Want to note that the interest that we earn on our investment is around 2%, so that 1.7% SRF funding is almost free money. We're doing better than we would by investing that money.
Who makes the loan applications? What department in the city?
Public Works. So last night, council authorized my signature on those loan applications. Okay. We'll be working. It'll be a cooperative effort. We'll need to work with our finance department to get, you know, the city's financial picture into those. We'll be working with planning on the environmental review. We'll need their help along with our consultants' help. So it'll be a team effort.
Yeah. And then one last question. You obviously had the two new staff. I assume they're full-time?
They are.
And so how's the overall turnover rate with city staffing?
In the utilities department, over the past 2 years, we've had a relatively higher turnover rate than we would have liked to have. you know, two employees left for greener pastures, and then two other ones basically left for other reasons. So but we have been consolidating some of those job titles in preparation for the new wharf, and so we actually have lost four individuals over the last 2 years and replaced two.
Okay, Jan.
Minor, really little questions. On the trees, I was asked this again the other day, and we talked about this a long time ago, and I forgot about the answer. The trees that are planted in the city right away in front of somebody's house. If I own a house and I don't have a sidewalk in front of my house and I plant a tree there, but it's on city right away property, is that my responsibility to take care of it, or is the city?
Per our municipal code, it's the city's responsibility. But if we're following all the code sections, you would need to get permission from the city to plant that tree. It's within the city's right of way.
Would it require an encroachment permit?
Yes. Typically for planting, it would be a no-fee encroachment permit.
So if you moved into a house that already had a tree in that situation, and there was a storm, does the city clean it up?
The city cleans it up. The last bigger storm that we had a couple of years ago, $45,000 worth of work cost the city to clean up, and we were reimbursed for a large portion of that because it was a declared disaster. Mm-hmm. But still, yes, we do incur those costs.
Okay. Because I thought I'd read in some of these reports that it was a homeowner's responsibility if it falls into a creek, I guess, and blocks the creek, and if it's on the homeowner's property, that's all.
If it's on their property, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so then another topic. I noticed on here that for the Oktoberfest, they're going to have free trolleys service. And then how does that happen? Do they pay a flat fee to the city for the trolleys?
I believe so. Janine can help us with that.
The Harbor Festival is actually reimbursing the city for fares. So in order to have that be a free service for that day. So we'll be counting how many passengers we take on the trolleys that day, and we calculate a 2 or 3 year average that each year we come up with, here's the amount of fares that you would be reimbursing us for.
Okay. So they're not renting it, they're just paying you for the fares.
Correct. Okay. It's actually, Harbor Festival weekend typically has been the last operating days for the season. And over the years, they've been paying for the fare reimbursement in order to have it be free for their event.
So do they pay that out of their funds, or does that come out?
That's out of the Harbor Festival.
Okay. Then are all three trolleys going to be running their regular routes for
yes.
that festival?
Yes. And usually what we do is have the waterfront trolley, because of the way the road closures are now, will kind of do a little bump up and around at the Dorns area. And the other two routes, the north route and the downtown route that don't come near, will come down to Olive and Morrow, and they'll have a stop there right at Dorns, at the Centennial Stairway, so that every route will have access to the event.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And then my other little interesting thing, they're set on here, that you built a kiosk in City Hall, installed a large aluminum frame kiosk on the front of the building. So do you mean the bulletin board that's on the front of the building? Because I went and stood there and looked for a kiosk.
Yes, it is an enclosed bulletin board.
Thank you.
Okay, Steve.
In any case, I only have one question. It's either going to be to Rob or Eric there. And because we haven't had many RFCAC meetings during the 218 process at all, I did have a quick question. And it's basically on Waterworks progress with the crossing the town line and the lift station and everything else, have they been actually working through the, while the 218 process was going on? Were they on hold? Are we closer to having a number of we know what it's going to cost to build a plant. That's the $64,000 question for me, is how much is it going to cost to get across the town, basically, and how close are we to having actual plans put out to bid?
So they have been working on it. We have a meeting with them tomorrow, as a matter of fact, to take a look at some of their interim deliverables. I think they have their project design report that's due November.
Are they at a certain percentage progress in, you know, in preparation? I mean, are they at 20%, 50%, you know? Where do you feel?
Probably about a 30% design report. So this project design report will allow us to make decisions on some of the alignments, whether it's a single lift station or multiple lift station project.
Oh.
And then they can proceed to final design at that point.
And probably it's my own memory, and I don't remember. When do you honestly see yourselves putting this out for the actual pulling in for RFP, or actually the bid process?
The bid process, yeah. For, is that summer of next year?
Oh, okay, so it's that far out. Okay.
Yeah, construction that following fall. We're trying to avoid the peak season for construction, although, you know, a lot of that area that will be disturbed, it really doesn't matter what time of year, we will be, there will be an impact to Quintana Road. And as we complete the project design report, we'll be doing more outreach to those businesses, sharing traffic control plans, schedules. We do not, at this point, plan or anticipate a complete closure of Quintana. Oh. There will be one-way traffic control for portions of it.
Yeah, I would think you honestly would have to require that. So basically, the plan itself will start prior to the construction crosstown. Is that correct?
Probably about the same time.
Oh, okay. So you're looking at maybe late summer next year.
Yes.
Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, and before I move it back to John, he has a couple more questions. But talking about trees, on San Jacinto, as I'm approaching Greenwood, there's a school crossing sign. This is going eastbound on San Jacinto. And it's very much obscured by a tree. Branches that have covered it up, so it sort of defeats the purpose of having this sign there. And I'm not quite sure whether the tree is on city property or on private property. It's, you know, a few feet in. So if it's on private property, can the city prune it, or do they need the permission of the property owner, or does the property owner, or can, do you notify the property owner?
We would first notify the property owner and give them an amount of time to make those corrections. If it's on private property, if it's in the right of way, we'd of course trim that. We'll take a look at that. I would anticipate tomorrow.
With school now in session, it's a lot more noticeable.
Yeah, and if it, like I said, if it's city property, we'll go ahead and trim that. Private property, give property owner notice. If they don't respond within a certain amount of time, we go ahead and do the work.
Okay, thank you. And let's see, John, you had a couple more questions.
Yeah, actually, Jan kind of hit it too. So I guess one comment or question I've got. So when I did the remodel on my house in Las Vegas, I was told I had to put in a street tree. Pruning of that tree could theoretically be handled by the city if I wanted it.
Unless you put it on your property, street trees can be within 10 feet of the right-of-way line.
Okay, well, all I know is, you know, Las Vegas has got a 25-foot
a very common occurrence around town.
And then the other thing, thank you for the kiosk. I have no clue what that was. And then what rock art are
there, in reference to?
I'm going to have to look.
Yes, all of the existing asphalt was just re-slurry coated and painted.
Okay, are there any additional questions? I think Jan said she has one also.
At the last meeting, we were talking about sidewalk repairs, and I mentioned a sidewalk on Main Street that's all, it's got orange lines around it, you know, across the parts. It's really raised up, and I didn't have the exact address. It's actually on the corner of Rennell and Main. There's an apartment building there, and there's very large cracks and uplifts in the sidewalk. Thank you. Go on.
You might get an answer.
I don't know about that one in particular, but I can answer a generalized question. Yes, we do mark the raised areas with orange paint. There's several of those throughout the town, probably dozens of those throughout the city. Right now, staff is fully engaged in other activities. Priority one right now is to stay ahead of the streets maintenance coming into the street treatment project. So we anticipate to be done with that in a couple weeks. We'll be able to get back on other tasks such as sidewalk repairs.
So if it's marked orange, it's not only just a warning, but it might imply that something will be done to it.
It is absolutely a warning. Yeah. We do have lists of those areas. We don't actually have a schedule when we're planning to break those apart and re-pour the concrete.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, then. Thank you also for giving us a printed copy of the water quality report. With that, we'll move on to item B2, which is the One Water Plan update.
And Eric Caceres of Corollo Engineers is going to be walking us through a presentation. This is interim deliverable with multiple chapters of the report prepared that you received hard copies of. Next step will be to complete this out, and we're looking for perhaps a joint City Council Public Works Advisory Board meeting to review the final document.
How would you like us to proceed as far as questions and comments? Do you want this to be done by sections or hold everything to the end or just randomly shout out? so that we move along at a proper pace.
We can stop at key points and see if there's any questions up to those points, and then continue to move on. It doesn't appear that we're going to be taking public comment on this item, unless somebody rushes down here and comes into the room, and then at that point we would take public comment. But we will proceed by a few slides at a time, stop, take a pause, questions, and then continue on. How okay. does that sound, Mr. Chair?
Does the rest of the board, can you hold your tongues until then? Wait for the proper pause. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. So, Mr. Chair, members of the board, Eric Caceres with the Corollo Engineers. So as Rob mentioned, we're at a bit of an interim deliverable. We have a number of the chapters that we've delivered. The stormwater analysis is a piece that is That is the last piece that we need to complete. And so as I was speaking with Mr. Irwin earlier about some of the questions he had sent, which we can go over those here after the presentation, there's a couple of key chapters that are missing because parts of those have to do with the stormwater system. And I'll go over that as we go through the presentation. So chapter 5 and chapter 8 are the big ones that are missing, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So just a little overview slide here about this one water concept. Again, this goes back several years in terms of the City Council's decision to take a look at its water infrastructure in a more holistic way, in line with a number of agencies throughout the country and a number of large agencies throughout California that have taken this approach, most notably the City of Los Angeles with their One Water LA plan that they recently adopted and finalized this past summer. But again, just looking at all of the city's water resources together in order to develop a new capital improvement programs moving forward for both the water, for the water, sewer, and stormwater systems. So what are the objectives of the One Water Plan? And the presentation is going to follow kind of these individual components, and I'll stop at the end of each component and we can talk. If you have any questions, I can address those. But first and foremost, it's to determine the necessary capital improvements to the city's key water resource infrastructure on the water distribution side, the sewer collection system, and the stormwater management system. The other key aspect of this report is to look at the city's portfolio of water resources and potential water water supply resources and make a determination about how the city should move forward in terms of securing a sustainable water supply for the future. And then the third is kind of in general informing the general plan and the development of the local coastal plan updates. And then towards the bottom here, which is not one necessarily customarily that we handle at the same time as we're developing this plan, but it's to inform the sewer rate study that was recently completed for the WRF program. And so we can talk a little bit about that kind of dynamic program or that dynamic process and how that rate study process and us doing the One Water Plan at the same time, how that process turned out. So in terms of the goals and objectives for this meeting, this really identifies kind of the four key areas that we're going to talk about. We're first going to go through the water distribution and wastewater collection system master planning efforts. We're then going to go through what we've completed thus far on the stormwater system in terms of identifying the deficiencies in the existing system. And then we'll go through the water supply. We'll finish with the water supply evaluation, and then the results of the water supply evaluation. We'll end with that. So in terms of the water master plan, what I have up here is a list of the different steps that we go through when we develop a water master planning document. And it really starts off with a pretty robust data analysis. And really even before that, it starts with a very robust data ask. We put together a long list of things that we need to get from the city, and we submit that to the city, and we take that data, and we do our analysis. In terms of the water master plan, one of the key elements that we look at is demand projections. So what is the city's need for potable water as we currently and then as we move forward? We then develop a hydraulic model of the existing water distribution system. And we calibrate that model using a number of different techniques that we'll talk a little bit about. We go through the planning and design criteria. So what are the criteria that we're going to use to determine if a component of the water distribution system is either it's either in good condition and it's going to serve the future needs of the city, or if it's what we call deficient. And we'll go through some of those. We look at the existing and the future system. So we take the model and we subject it to the demand conditions that we've identified, and we figure out if there's any deficiencies. Once we identify those deficiencies, we categorize those as either current or future deficiencies. We go through and we develop recommended improvements to fix those deficiencies, and then we develop a cost for those recommendations, and that rolls up into a capital improvement program that we then phase over a 20-year time period.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
Stop you. Does it seem I don't follow the whole One Water name. I don't know if that's just a new name for general plan updates of the water and sewer system for most towns. Is this over a five-year planning period that has to be updated at that point in time for the state, or is this something that's going to go out further in the future?
No, this is a 20-year planning horizon for the capital improvement.
So you don't need to re-update it every 5 years?
It's recommended. Industry standards would like it to be updated about every 5 years, or when there's significant changes to your system, because things change. And you wouldn't want we have a 20-plus-year-old water system master plan.
No,
it doesn't make sense anymore.
Rob, it's just, for me, it looks like a water master plan update, you know,
yep.
a sewer,
yep.
storm drain. The one water concept for me, you know, I assume this is just nomenclature trying to tie all three together.
It is, and the fact that we're doing really what makes this the one water plan, and rather than, you know, if this was 5 years ago, what we would call it in the office would be a triple master plan,
right.
is what we would call them. It's a water, sewer, and storm master plan. The fact that we've included the pretty robust water supply evaluation component brings that together. And depending on the community that we're looking at, there can be, and the different components that we look at, there can be some overlap between, you know, using storm water for a water supply benefit, or potentially on the wastewater side, if this was looking at treatment and recycled water, again, we are looking at that, then you're now blurring the lines between what would be conventionally be considered the sewer or the wastewater system and the potable water system.
Okay. Sorry, so kind of
that's
point.
No, that's fine. And then typically these documents are developed and to be consistent with kind of general plan updates, and so the planning horizons are typically the same as the general plan. So we use a lot of land use elements and everything from the general plan to do
Thank
that.
You.
So this slide up here just shows a picture, essentially a screenshot from the model. This is a model of the city's existing water distribution system in terms of all of the larger diameter pipelines, the city's well fields, and the storage tanks, and the water treatment plant. This is an overview of the different pressure zones in the city. So we really break the city's water distribution system down into the individual pressure zones, and we do an evaluation on those individual pressure zones to identify the deficiencies within those. So we look at a pressure zone to see, number one, is there enough storage in that individual pressure zone? And is it the case with some of these analyses, there can be links between different pressure zones, and there was a little bit of that here with the city of Morro Bay, where you have a higher pressure zone where we may break head down into a lower pressure zone. And so we've been able to combine certain pressure zones to where one may look deficient on its own, but if you combine them together, there's enough storage between the two pressure zones. So we'll go into a little bit of that. But we have the first zone, which is the upper and lower King zone. Zone B is the upper, is the Elena zone. We have the Nutmeg zone, Zone C, the Blanca zone, and the Ridgeway zone. So those are described a little bit more in the report, but that's just a general breakdown of the different zones. So on the water side, we really look at the system, and how we determine deficiencies is the first thing that we look at is pressure deficiencies. So we have criteria that we apply to the distribution system, both under current and future conditions, to identify if there are deficiencies. And the three demand conditions that we typically look at are the average day demand. So that's kind of the average day. You know, if you average every day of the year, the average day. The peak hour demand, which is typically the hottest day of the year, when the most amount of irrigation and water use is going on, and that peak hour of that peak day is the peak hour demand. And then we have the maximum day demand, which is that maximum day, not necessarily that peak hour, but the maximum day. And we put a fire flow on top of that, and we look at what the pressures are in the system. So this is showing kind of the minimum pressure criteria that we use for the peak hour, and I'll go through some of the planning criteria here, is 40 PSI. So you can see that under the peak hour condition, the majority of the system is green, which is good, which means it's above the 40 PSI.
So I got a little bit ahead of myself, but pressure criteria that we use to evaluate the city's distribution system is consistent with industry standards. So again, we apply that peak hour demand condition over the whole system, and we look in individual areas where that are less than 40 PSI. So we would expect during the highest demand period of the year, absolute highest demand period, we would still be above 40 PSI throughout the system. We then look at the maximum day demand condition. Again, we apply the fire flow on top, and we want to make sure that we have a minimum of 20 PSI under that condition. And then really during average day demand, because we need to maintain high pressures, higher pressures during high demand periods, what's going on during the lower pressure periods? There we can worry about things like excessive pressure. And so we look at more of a maximum pressure under that condition, which is 120 PSI. We also use pipeline velocity as a measure of deficiency. We typically use different criteria for looking at existing infrastructure versus when we plan and recommend an improvement. We have a different set of criteria that we use for new infrastructure. The reason that we do that is it depends. It's kind of on a case-by-case basis as we look at a system. If you apply too stringent of a criteria, it can look like the whole system is deficient. So it's one of the things that we look at and use our judgment and work with staff to figure out what the right criteria are. But in this case, we looked at all the pipelines and existing pipelines in the city under the current and future demand conditions, and we said a pipeline is deficient if the velocity in that pipeline is over 8 feet per second during the peak hour. Now, over 8 feet per second, yeah. That's what we would consider excessive velocity, essentially, higher head losses and those kinds of things. However, if we look at something and we say, okay, we need to run a new pipeline out to a new area of town, we use a more conservative 5 feet per second for anything under a 16-inch pipe and 4 feet per second in anything over a 16-inch pipe for planning new infrastructure. So we don't say, we're using 8 feet per second to determine if something existing is deficient, but if we're putting in a new pipeline, we use a somewhat more conservative velocity.
Is most of the pipes in this town, I'm unfamiliar with the infrastructure, is mainly asbestos cement for most of it, or is it?
Yes, that's correct.
It is AC, okay. Yeah. Thanks.
I have a breakdown somewhere of the individual pipelines in the town, the distribution based on diameter and everything else. I don't think there's a terrible amount above 16.
But when you look at upgrades, you're looking at like Blue Brood or one of the PVC.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, C900 PVC is C900. What their standard is.
Yeah. I've got a question.
Sure.
Getting back to the pressure in the pipes.
Yeah.
I live on Hemlock, and we frequently have pressure lower than 20, sometimes 15. And when we revamp the system and so on, are we going to bring the other tie-ins, laterals and so on, up to pressure with the new system?
Actually, we haven't identified a lot of new improvements to the water distribution system. There are some improvements that we'll go through. Those individual pressure issues are something that we can look into.
You want to answer something to add to that? Yeah, actually, I know we've been out to your house numerous times and looked at the pressure, and really where your pressure really drops is that second story, that elevation. So at the street level, we're still meeting minimums. When we get to those two-story level in that area, that's when we really start seeing those issues.
So, Joe, the minimum is 20 pounds. Is that right?
Yeah.
Because I put a gauge down there, and sometimes it's not quite 20. But when I gauge it upstairs, you're right. It's 15 or 12.
Yeah, that's when it really drops. And like I said, I know we've been to your residence numerous times and have checked that for you, and it's just that second story when you start going up and then the smaller diameter pipes, you get a lot of loss in that.
And some of my neighbors have boost pumps in. And when their boost pump comes on, of course, my pressure goes to almost nothing. And is it legal to put boost pumps in the system?
Yeah, the plumbing code does allow. In fact, it's required, for example, on Nutmeg Avenue, yeah, where you're just down below the base of the tank, they have booster pumps that are required to provide enough pressure, not only for the domestic side, but for the fire system.
Well,
does that create cavitation at all through as you're going through the meters with a booster pump trying to get it up? I've never heard of it. I'll be honest with you. I've never heard where people are putting booster pumps.
No, the biggest problem with those pumps, and they say right on it, is basically you can create cavitation in the pump because you can actually suck air into those. You know, so you'll actually cavitate the pump and vibrate the pipes in your house because there's only so much you can pull, especially if you're feeding through older lines, you know, coming from the street that aren't sized to be doing that.
And the 20 PSI residuals, the fire, that's the UFC, as I remember, requires that for fire flow only.
Yeah.
I was understanding it's 40.
40.
PSI
40 would
minimum
be. Yeah. 40 would be what we would
for
shoot
the
for.
Services to people.
And that can be a somewhat idealized situation. That we don't always, for all of the systems that we looked at, that's not necessarily the criteria. But the kind of the baseline criteria is 40 PSI.
Oh, okay.
There are situations where we've gone lower than that.
You're right.
Because of just some of the fundamental limitations.
20 sounds very low for residential.
20 is 20 is low. No. The idea is that it would be somewhere around 40, and then you have a fire, and it would go down to 20.
And 40 works for most people.
Yeah. So the other infrastructure that we look at are the pump stations and the tanks in the water distribution system. And so for the pump stations, we look at the firm capacity meeting with the largest pump out of service. That we're able to serve the maximum day demand. So this is the criteria that we use for the pump stations. And then fire flow criteria, we coordinated early on, staff coordinated with the fire department to come up with these different fire flow, both the flow and the durations. And so we were able to, essentially the way that we look at it is we look at it on a by zone basis, and we apply the most restrictive essentially fire flow requirement. So, for example, if we have a public facility in one of the zones, if we have a public facility and we have a commercial facility in one zone, we would run the analysis using that 4,000 gallons per minute for 4 hours on that zone, since that's the most restrictive condition.
Now, the fire trucks have boost pumps in them, don't they? So even if it's 10 or 15 pounds per square inch in the line, boost it up higher than that. Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. Yeah, this is what we would be serving at the essentially at the hydrant is what we're
Yeah, so what we do is we, in the model, we induce that flow, and we see what the pressure is in the system at the next nearest hydrant. Yeah. So we don't want to drop that pressure down below 20 PSI in the system when we're flowing a hydrant at that required fire flow. There are situations where the pipes aren't big enough where you can actually go to negative pressure in the system if you're trying to pull too much out of it. That will result in pulling water out of the house and into the system, typically out of the hot water heater. And that's not a good thing to dry a hot water heater.
So then in terms of storage, again, we looked at the storage in each of the individual zones. Storage is really made up of three components. One is the operational component, so what we would expect to be kind of fluctuating on a twice daily or a daily basis depending on how the zone operates, the fire storage, and then the some amount of emergency storage. And so the criteria that we use here in terms of the storage criteria is something that, again, we typically work with the community that we're doing the work for. We sit down and we figure out what's the most appropriate criteria to use. Typically, the operational or equalization storage is of 25% of the maximum day demand. That's pretty common, and that's what we used here for this analysis. The fire suppression storage is equal to the maximum fire the required for the flow per zone. So again, looking at the individual zone and looking at what condition governs, is it a public facility, is it a commercial facility, is it just all single family residential? That's how we determine the required fire storage in each zone. And then emergency storage is 150% of the average day demand.
Real quick, Eric, do you have to do that for each zone?
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
They're all done independent. Were there any, none of the tests are run where there's any type of codependency or anything like that, correct?
Between the individual zones?
Yeah.
We actually did some connecting, and we'll get into that a little bit, is actually if you look at, and we looked at some improvements to create a connection between different zones, we can take advantage of, you know, one zone has more storage than it needs and one has less storage. You average it out and you have enough for both combined, and so we looked at that in a couple of conditions. So this is a little bit small. You should be able to see it in your packet, but this is essentially the storage deficiencies that we identified. And we actually identified storage deficiencies in a couple of zones. These shouldn't be a huge surprise. The first one on the top is the Nutmeg Zone. That's a project. Replacement and upsizing of that Nutmeg tank is something that the city's been looking at for a while. The Blanca Zone and the Ridgeway Zone also had deficiencies. So just want to highlight a couple of the improvements that we identified for the water distribution system. Again, a couple of the large ones. One was the Elena tank and replacing that with a new, larger 150,000-gallon tank, and then replacing the Nutmeg tank with approximately 1 million gallon tank.
What's their current capacity?
So the Elena tank's current capacity.
I don't have my magnifying glass today.
Okay,
so
I'm looking at it. Oh, we combined the Elena and King's zones there. I'll have to get back to you on the Elena tank itself. The Nutmeg tank is only 140,000 gallons. So the recommendation is 1 million gallons versus the existing capacity of 140,000 gallons.
Thank you.
So again, two of the major projects. We also identified some issues with the pumping capacity of some of the city's pump stations. Two of them. One was the Elena pump station, and the other one was the Vashon pump station. And one of the things that we did work with operations staff, one when we did all of our site visits in the field, and then in working with some of the water operations staff and with Joe, we identified some improvements in the city, or they had some ideas for some improvements in the city that would allow us to eliminate this Vashon pump station. And so this Vashon pump station is pretty problematic for the city to operate and maintain now. It's located in someone's front yard, but with some cross connection between some different zones, we're able to eliminate this pump station. So a pump station that was deficient, which we would have had to upsize, but is also an operations and maintenance headache for staff, we're going to be able to eliminate with connection or with the addition of some piping and interconnection of a few zones. We also look at fire flow deficiencies, and we found fire flow deficiencies throughout the city in terms of the maximum velocities that we see through the pipes when you apply the fire, when you apply fires in different locations. So this map here shows everything in red is what we would call quote-unquote deficiency, meaning that the velocities exceeded the 8 feet per second criteria that we identified.
So that's the only deficiency is the fact you're exceeding velocity.
Essentially exceeding the velocities.
You still get the 1,500 GPM with the 20.
Yep.
Thank you.
So why is it deficient if you're exceeding velocity?
Because of the head loss. And it is just generally just for the system itself, you don't want to be operating at those kinds of velocities. It's more of a just an industry standard for how we the system should be operating.
Well, it is, but it's very seldom you're actually pulling fire flow to fight a fire.
Correct.
Talking about this for 20 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, that's why we identify it, and it's not necessarily the highest priority improvements that we identify.
I mean, you can still get the 1,500, you get the 20 PSI residual, so...
So as I mentioned, what we do is based on those deficiencies, which are, this is the summary sheet here, the larger 11 by 17 sheets in your handout show a couple of things. There should be kind of four different things that you're looking at there. The first one is the first sheet, or first two sheets, I believe. The water side is two sheets. It shows we came up with a CIP. We looked at the system and we said, hey, here are the current and future deficiencies. And here's our idealized CIP for the next 20 years. These are all the things that need to be done to the distribution system over the next 20 years. And you'll see the total cost is about $26.1 million. And then we have a breakdown between the first 5 years, the second 5 years, and then the last 10 years. So you'll notice that. Essentially what you're looking at is just an expanded view of this one. This has some of the major categories that we looked at, or that we break it down into. Back in April of this year, so we started the rate process, the development of new water and sewer rates to support the water reclamation facility, but not only to support the water reclamation facility, but also to support the capital improvements that we identified in the One Water Plan. So the city manager created a blue ribbon commission consisting of four individuals in the community that the WRF program team, myself, city staff, our rate consultant, all worked together with their main goal was really to try to make the WRF and the other improvements to the city's infrastructure as affordable as possible. And so while we had this idealized view of the 20-year CIP, our wish list, they really challenged us to take that CIP, us and the city staff, to look at that CIP and say, can we push off some things that may not be as high of a priority as we originally thought, with a goal, again, of trying to minimize rate increases and increase the affordability for the community. So once we did that, you'll see the next two pages in that larger 11 by 17 set is the revised CIP. Again, this isn't something that we typically do because of the timing. We typically put together a master plan. We take our best guess at what the CIP should look like. Then it goes and it goes to city staff, takes it, they do a rate study, and then they implement the projects from there. We actually kind of did this together. And so we have this revised CIP. Again, you still have the same $26.1 million over the 20 years, but you'll notice that the breakdown between the first 10 years is quite a bit different than the second 10 years. So this was a much more front-loaded, the original version, where we have about $22 million of that $26.1 million in the first 10 years. Here we have about $13 million in that first 10 years. And so that was one of the things that we did. We prioritized, and you'll see the projects that we have prioritized in there, including one of the big ones is the Nutmeg Tank project is in there. So again, kind of an iterative process that we went through to, okay, what can we live with? What can we push out? What does that do to the rates? So we went through this exercise both on the water distribution side and on the collection system side that we're getting get into now.
Before you jump into the collection system, mm-hmm. I just have one question. I keep beating it, and maybe I'm wrong on it. Is anywhere in the system you cannot provide 1,500 GPM with the 21 or 20 PSI residual? Is it purely the velocities in all cases that require?
Yeah, I believe so. I take a look at that, but I believe so.
Okay. I worry about one if you can't get the water to the fire, whether you exceed 8 feet per second for a couple hours or something. I don't know why. I don't lose sleep over that.
No, I'll definitely get back to you. I'll look into that and just double check that.
Fair enough. I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
And we did keep some of the fire flow. I believe we kept some of the fire flow improvements in that first 10 years. So,
I guess part of that is, you say there's fire flow deficiencies. So deficiency, is kind of a negative mm-hmm. connotation. And then you step forward and you show in those first 5 years, $0 spent on fire flow improvements. So mm-hmm. I just know that the project's fairly polarizing, or it's gone from disagreements to a little bit of aggression in the town mm-hmm. with all the constituents. So you step up and say, hey, we have a deficiency in fire flow, which really feels like a safety hazard.
Sure.
And then you're saying, but we're not going to address that in the first 5 years. So it just rolls out.
I think it's
wrong.
The way it feels. Chris is right.
Yeah, the term deficiency is kind of, we use that as a blanket term. Anything that doesn't meet the criteria that we've identified.
If the fire department can't keep their pumps flowing, that's a problem. Whether you exceed the velocities, That is a concern mm-hmm. long term, but it's for such a short period of time, I think you might want to try and put this in a light,
sure,
if you follow what I'm
saying. And I think the fire flow says, you know, that it's 12 million three, but then it shows the spend only at about, you know, 9 million 6. So I'm not sure where the other 3 million went.
I can take a look at that. Okay. Yeah. The other thing to note is, and I didn't show it. It's not broken down here in the presentation to that granular of a level, but we're looking at both current and future build out conditions. The city of Morro Bay is a bit of a unique position to where we're looking at a general plan that really takes the city to build out. So how long it takes to get to build out? There's a fairly sizable increase between current demands and where that build out is going to be.
And a question to Rob is how close is this project in parallel with the general plan? You know,
they're both consistent with each other. So we use the population numbers from the general plan. So we're taking it to the. It's estimated at 2040. I don't know if we'll actually get to build out in 2040, but the 12,200 population is really the key.
Well, it's also a small percentage when you truly think of the growth in this town. I mean, this is a very low growth town.
It's about 2% a year.
Yeah. Oh, is it that much? Okay.
But yeah, I can get you some more information. If it's not in the report, I'll take a look at what's in the report, and we can get some more information on the fire flow.
You might want to label it as something other than a, you know, like for fire capacity or something like that.
Yeah, the word deficiency sounds like you're not getting enough water to
sure.
spot. You know, that's what I was concerned.
Engineers, we think in black or white. It's either okay or it's deficient.
You got it.
So on the collection system side, and I'll go through some of these slides fairly quickly because it's a fairly similar process in terms of we rebuild the city system and take the GIS information and we import it into the model. We do an evaluation of the wastewater generation and we do that. We also develop, as we do on the water side, some planning and evaluation criteria that we use to subject the system to again figure out what the deficiencies are. Once we identify those, we recommend improvements to fix them, and then after that, we develop the CIP, similar to the water side. So again, this is the model of the city's existing sewer system. Again, what we're interested here are the gravity pipes in the ground and then the city's three lift stations, and we'll go through a discussion of that infrastructure. The one thing that we do is with the sewer system, because of inflow and infiltration, the influence of stormwater on sewer flows, is we actually apply a design storm to the model, and we can predict what the flows in the collection system are based on that design storm. For the city of Morro Bay, again, this is kind of industry standard, pretty consistent. It's a 10-year, 24-hour storm that we subject the system to in order to understand what the peak conditions are in the sewer system. So again, the peak flows in the sewer system are governed by wet weather. As we had the velocity criteria for the water distribution system piping, for gravity sewers, we use a little bit different criteria. We looked at the city system, and there's a couple of different well-accepted criteria that we use to, again, determine deficiencies of the gravity sewer system. One would be if we keep all of the flow in the pipe. So some cities will use that as a measure of deficiency. So once we start to get water that's going out of the pipe and into the collection system manhole, that was what we would assume deficient. The other commonly used criteria is 5 feet below the manhole rim. So it's 5 feet from essentially the street. So we let water back up in the collection system up to 5 feet, and then another would be 2 feet. I've seen more extreme cases where they've let it, actually certain manhole surcharge and other things, but or spills, but that's not very common. So for the case from Morro Bay, we're using 5 feet below the manhole rim. So essentially any pipe where the flow is getting such that the water is less than 5 feet from the street level would be termed deficient.
Just a quick quick question. Mm-hmm. Is there anywhere where the manholes are less than 5 feet deep? Yeah, I guess there is.
Yeah, we have a.
I don't know the town's infrastructure, but I'm sure there's areas where you're less.
Yeah, point. We have a couple locations where we have some shallow lines in the beach tract. Flat, shallow
lines. Yeah, so where those lines are modeled, I had to look and see what the criteria is there. We're probably trying to just keep all the flow in the pipe.
And the only other problem I see when you leave the pipe is the fact that you'll get sludge actually collecting on the bottom of the manhole when it goes up, and then when it goes back down, the residuals left within the manhole. Okay, thank you.
Yep. And then as we discussed with the water system, we also use a different set of criteria when we plan new pipes. So if we're putting new pipelines in, we wouldn't plan them, so we would surcharge and be five feet below the rim.
That's
we
what
would
I
keep,
wanted to hear.
We would keep all of the flow within the pipe. So we use a D over D ratio of 0.75. The D is the depth in the pipe. The small D is the depth of flow in the pipe. The big D is the diameter of the pipe. And then we look at lift stations again, like we looked at the pump stations and the distribution system. We're looking at the firm capacity being able to pump the peak wet weather flow. Again, when we apply that 10-year, 24-hour storm event, do we have enough with one unit out, the largest unit out of service, to meet that capacity? So we did identify a small amount of deficiency in lift station one. Again, lift station one is down by the cloisters area. Again, this is caused by the higher flows that are experienced during a rain event, significantly large rain event. So we did see a deficiency there. There's actually some other improvements that could be made potentially in the cloisters area to reduce that INI and potentially avoid having to make this improvement. So when we got into the CIP and worked through that, the way that we structured the CIP is that we would do some projects to reduce the flows in that area so that we could potentially avoid increasing the pump sizes in lift station number one. The city's deficiencies as it relates to the gravity pipelines in the city are actually mostly congregated around the Main Street line. Again, a line that, because of condition, has been targeted by the city for rehabilitation and or replacement for a long time. So it's actually kind of it's a good thing we're seeing a pipe that has some condition issues, also has some capacity issues. So you kind of have two different driving forces there for doing something about the pipes there.
When you say Main Street, are you talking North Morrow Bay, South Morrow Bay? What section of Main?
You can see it's actually kind of both. So there's Atascadero Road, and anything in red here, although going all the way up, is deficient, and then down here is deficient. There's a little bit of a distinction made between what we call primary and secondary deficiencies, where certain deficiencies are caused because of downstream restrictions. So if you fix something downstream, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to fix something upstream. It's just that it's showing deficient upstream because you have a bottleneck downstream. So we look at that, and that's something that we roll into our analysis. In addition to these deficiencies, we also have some ongoing capital activities that we included in the CIP based on our discussions with staff, and then again a bit of our professional judgment and what we look at and recommend for a number of different cities. Rehabilitation in the area west of Highway 1. So again, that area was identified in the flow monitoring study that was done to help support this project as the area of highest INI within the city. So reduction of INI is a good thing, and we have kind of an annual allotment of money in the CIP in order to help fix pipes in that area to reduce the INI. Again, periodic master plan updates. The more frequently the master plan is updated, the less effort it is. And also, it's a good way of looking and saying, okay, our CIP said to do this over the first 5 years. This happened. We needed to fix this instead. It lets you kind of re-rack the CIP and actualize and say, well, we're going to do this in 5 years. We said we're going to do these six projects. We actually decided to do these seven projects instead. and you can kind of recalibrate your CIP and keep pushing it out another 5 years. So just good general practice. General pipeline replacements because of condition, as this, you know, Joe and his staff are constantly replacing and repairing pipelines throughout the city. So again, we put in money to account for that, so that shows up in the CIP. Periodic flow monitoring is also a good idea. So as you're replacing these different pipelines, specifically in the area west of Highway 1, you're doing flow monitoring during wet weather to see, well, we did these projects to reduce INI. What is it really? Is it really working? So are we really seeing reduced wet weather flows when we have a large storm event? And then manhole replacement citywide, again, something that Joe and his crew are constantly doing. Again, this is the rolled up, kind of idealized first shot at the CIP. You know, without budgetary constraints, where would we be? So again, the expanded version of that is the third 11x17 document in the back of your handout. As you'll see, it's an $18.1 million or $18.2 million over 20 years. You can see the breakdown is about $8 million in the first 5 years, $4.6 million in the next 5 years, and then $5.7 in the remaining 10 years. But as we did with the water distribution system, we also had to do a bit of a we had to make some decisions on priority, and we ended up pushing out some projects. But again, the focus for the CIP in the first 5 years is really trying to fix the improvements that we see on that Main Street line, particularly the area north of Highway 41.
Okay. Before you leave the sewer side of it to the stormwater, a quick question. It seems like there's an inordinate amount of INI in this town, or at least it feels like to me, that's coming into the pipes, into the system. Is it mainly coming through the manholes, or are these joints in the pipes that you're mainly experiencing this from? I mean, is it the manhole rings are leaking where it looks like a waterfall when it rains, or is it the type of thing where the is it old clay pipe? Is that what most of this town's made of?
Yeah.
I just wondered where you were seeing the most INI from, because manholes are kind of easy to fix.
Mm-hmm.
Relining actual sewer lines is a little bit more of a...
Yeah.
It's a combination of
I assume it's a combination. I mean, are you seeing an inordinate amount?
Yeah,
we have a few, probably in order of magnitude from less to greater, some illicit connections where people have inadvertently tied roof leaders or things into.
So that's inflow as opposed to the infiltration.
Yeah. So for this project, the flow monitoring study was done by the city back in the spring of last year. And so look at what's going on during dry weather in different areas throughout the city, and then what's going on during wet weather to figure out what's the overall magnitude of the INI. And then smoke testing was done back in spring of this year?
Yeah.
Spring of this year, which will give you a sense of the it'll identify. It won't necessarily tell you the magnitude of what's coming from things getting in through joints versus direct connections or – you know, leaking manhole rooms.
So direct connections are a real problem. I realize down that beach area track you had a bit of that going on back in the day. But
yeah, actually, we found some direct connections through the smoke testing, the areas where we identified the real high inflow, the INI during the storms, because we can tell through – we had a lot of temporary meters set up through the system to basically – judge for not only this project but also for sizing of the new wharf plant.
Oh, okay.
So we were able to identify the areas that were getting a lot. So we actually smoke tested that area, and you know, in the course of probably four blocks that we did, we probably found, you know, a half dozen to a dozen you know, connections that were either driveway drains, you know, outside showers, that type of stuff, roof drains connected in. But we sent deficiency letters to all the homeowners, and I got to say, excellent response from the community. All of them, you know, fixed them without a second letter. You know, we've had
cool.
call to follow up, and we went out and double-checked, and it's just been a great response. You know, the community really stepped up and fixed that.
So you think once you get a handle on that, maybe the joint leakage isn't that bad and the pipes themselves.
No, the joints are still bad. So we identified that that beach track area. We do know that that is a high INI area.
Oh.
So during storms, we've been out there and we've actually, you know, videotaped during the storm events to try and identify some of the worst parts. When they put the new freeway in, they actually just cut those lines. They used to go straight across, and sometimes they put a cap on the end, sometimes they didn't.
It's a French drain.
Yeah, so years and years of cleaning. A lot of times, inadvertently, the crews pop the other side out. So we do know that that area, they're all in backyards, as we identify. And with the new camera that the city purchased last year, we now have in-house camera equipment. So during storm events, we actually plan and we go out and we actually videotape.
Oh, okay.
So I would say the majority is, you know, the pipes themselves.
Oh, okay. So
we do have some...
Manholes aren't that bad.
They definitely are, we can mitigate that inflow. So
right.
We actually put liners in a lot of them. We do have manholes in low-lying areas that flood out, but we can actually seal and put manhole liners in there and mitigate a lot of that inflow.
Oh.
So without doing that, yes, it's definitely a problem, but we can take steps to try and start cutting that down. You know, and we have identified those low-lying areas through the CIP program to actually, you know, as they come up, to actually fix and replace and move those lines.
Oh, okay.
So.
Because, yeah, you got 4 or 5 years before your new plant comes online,
yeah.
And it'd be nice to get some of that cleared up.
Yeah.
Thank you. You
mentioned the excessive INI. You know, essentially, we talk about it mostly. I do a lot of wastewater treatment plant design work. We talk about it in terms of peaking factor. That's what we always relate the average annual flow to this peak hour flow. And the city of Morro Bay is somewhere in the range of like a 7 to 8 peaking factor, meaning that wet weather about seven, eight times higher than what the average day conditions would be. That's not something that's uncharacteristic of other treatment plants or other communities that we deal with.
I know Santa Maria pretty proficiently, and it's usually down around 3.5 mm-hmm. on the peak, but it's a much larger town.
Yeah,
so
that's one of the things that plays into it too.
Absolutely.
Now, and Rob, you had mentioned that the way you generally account for this peaking flow is you provide some sort of reservoir up there to hold the peak flow there, so you can treat it, and it's not a huge cost for the wastewater recycling facility.
A lot of times, a treatment plant is designed with an equalization basin ahead of the treatment process to allow that flow to be metered in and treated at a regular rate. This new WRF facility does have some equalization. The proposer also has another idea to help to deal with those peak flows, providing different type of treatment for those peak flows, not going through the main process, and using a little less expensive treatment process rather than trying to run everything through the MBR process.
I think they call it the SAFE system.
It stands for something, and I can never remember.
Yeah,
what it
I don't remember
for.
The acronym.
Yeah. Yeah.
Approximately, what's the additional cost for this, or what's the cost for this equalization?
You know, depending, you know, we could go down the treatment plant rabbit hole a lot here. A lot of cities with this type of peaking factor, depending on the process they're using, would not have any kind of equalization. It just really depends on, number one, the treatment process that you're using, and everything else, and the nature of what governs the majority of the cost of a treatment facility and everything is usually not the peak wet weather flow. That's going to dictate the sizing of piping and everything in the treatment plant and the pumping facilities, but core of your process is not typically dictated by the what you see a couple hours of the year, a couple days of the year, typically.
When they do the SBRs, then you do have to have equalization.
SBRs, and Okay, well, we'll move on to stormwater here. So again, stormwater is where we've made We're making good progress. We're trying to finish up the improvements in the CIP right now. The green checks here show what we've done to date. We've gone through and done the data analysis. We've built the model. We developed the planning and design criteria, and we've looked at the stormwater system to identify deficiencies. And so I'll run through quickly what we don't have, again, are the recommended improvements and the CIP developed as of yet. That's what we'll be bringing back in October. Again, a screenshot of the storm drain system model that we've used to evaluate the system. So obviously a little bit different here. Well, not too different from the collection system. It's actually the same modeling engine that we use for the collection system as what we use for the stormwater system. But we apply different design storms to the storm drain system in order to figure out the deficiencies. So we use two different storms that we route through the model to determine the deficiencies. Oops. One is a 10-year event, total of 4.1 inches, and a 100-year event, which is a 7.1 inches. Again, planning and design criteria fairly draw a parallel to what we've talked about previously. We're looking at minimal street flooding during the 10-year design storm event. So under this more frequently occurring event, we look at trying to contain it a little bit better. And then during a 100-year event, we allow for 1 foot of surcharging during that 100-year event.
Eric, real quick on the previous slide, the 4.10, 7.12, that's a volume over a 24-hour
period. You can see the distribution. Right. You can see the distribution.
Gotcha.
Peaking at the 100-year peaks at about 1.8 inches an hour, which is
right.
I live in Fresno. I don't even know what these numbers don't even make sense to me.
A little wetter here.
These are huge events for me.
Yeah.
This right here shows the flooding that was identified over the 10-year storm event. So you can see these red dots here identified where flooding was occurring. And then during the 100-year event, you can see some additional flooding or flooding that exceeded the 1 foot surcharge that we identified. Mr. Irwin submitted a question earlier, and it was something that we were talking about before the meeting here tonight about kind of this QAQC process, and we can get into a little bit of this at the end of the presentation. We have an internal QAQC process that we use, Corolo does, with some of our in-house specialists in these different areas. But one of the things that we did do for the water, sewer, and the stormwater system is when we modeled the system and we identified deficiencies, actually, storm is pretty nice because it's fairly visible when there's deficiencies. And so what we did is when we modeled the events, we came in with a large map where we had identified the different flooding areas or areas where there was flooding. Working with Damaris and some other staff, we were able to kind of fact check that to say, okay, our model is showing that we've got flooding in these seven different areas. Do you guys see flooding in these areas? Yeah. Do you guys see flooding? We always see flooding in this area that's not shown in the model. Okay, well, let's dig into the model and figure out, do we have the elevations incorrect? Are we not showing a DI in the right location or whatever that might be? So that was another kind of QAQC that we did on these three different systems as we walked through and identified the deficiencies, fact-checking the model as much as we can.
Before you leave the waste or the storm drainage side, and there's more to Rob, there's really no storm drain pipes in this town other than under drains, under intersections, and then they bubble out. Is that correct? Is there, I guess what I'm wondering is when you talk about conveyance to the bay or whatever, it's mainly street flows, isn't it, that carries it down?
For the most part, we do have a couple of larger systems. There's one that comes down Pacific Street that starts.
Oh, okay. So Pacific Street does have an actual.
Yeah, but it doesn't start up very far in the community.
Okay.
Somewhere on Morro Bay Boulevard is it starts. So everything would be generally surface flow or DIDOs.
Going under drains.
Going in under an intersection and then bubbled back up. North end of town, there's some conveyance under the highway. We've tied into that with some systems. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, nothing really picking up DIs, take it all the way.
We don't really have a networked system of storm drains that is relatable to, like, our sewer collection system.
So it brings me to the next point, and that's this slide and the slide before it. What is the criteria that says it's flooded? When do you consider the 10-year storm flooding a street? Does that mean up to the... Most places don't have curbs in a lot of this town. I'm wondering, what does that mean for the street itself?
The minimal street flooding?
Half a foot deep, a foot deep?
Minimal means that there's some type of ponding that's going on is what minimal flooding is. I mean, it's a bit of a nuanced thing about what exactly flooding area is. I can look. There's probably something in the report about the actual physical criteria that the model identifies to say this is deficient, this is flooding. But then the 100-year event is a little bit less subjective.
So you're saying it's up to 100 foot of surcharging. So 100 foot of
1 foot of surcharging. Yeah, 1 foot of surcharging under a 100-year storm event. So during that really big, you know, we're peaking at 1.8 inches an hour of rain.
Right.
Unless we are flooding more than a foot, then we're considering that not to be deficient.
So if it's a foot in the street, you're good to go.
You're good. Yeah, under a 100-year event. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Since I'm not an engineer, when all the storm drains into the storm drains along the streets, and these pipes run, where do they run parallel to the sewer pipes? Where do they end up? Where does the water exit?
Most of them don't reach the bay. Most of them are going under an intersection, bubbling up on the other side of the intersection and coming back
onto the street. Yeah, so we see it'll be street flow, and it can go underneath the street and then kind of resurface in street flow. And there's not a whole, as Rob was mentioning and Mr. Shively was mentioning before, there isn't a lot of pipe
infrastructure
in the storm in the stormwater system.
But the water ends up in the ocean.
In the ocean, yeah.
Yeah. So south of the rock, it ends up in the bay.
That wasn't criticism, Rob.
Yeah.
It was
north of the
an
rock,
observation.
Yeah, north of the rock, a lot of it will flow into the few urban streams that we have along there and then into the ocean. Some of it goes directly. For example, there's a Atascadero Road has a discharge line that goes out in just beyond the end of Atascadero Road at that kind of parking area that one side of the street is state parks, one side is city park.
So there's no storm drain system that's takes it to a certain place?
No.
But doesn't that have to happen if it's going to be in this one water?
Many cities don't have a network storm system that take it all to one place. In fact, that's probably a rarity.
Then how do you
storm drain design, back when I was learning how to do storm drain design, was get it to the ocean as quickly as possible. Drain your streets as quickly as you can. Now what the design philosophy is now is slow it down, get it back into the ground as quickly as possible, have as little runoff as possible.
So that's how it will be part of the recycled water, by getting it back into the ground.
It could be, yeah.
Yeah, it could be. A lot of the city does not overlie groundwater basins, though. The groundwater basins that we use are in the Moro Valley. Very little of the city overlies that basin. Or in the Choro Valley, almost none of the city overlies that basin. So these storm drain systems are unlikely to provide any portion of water that would be pumped back out of the ground. Now, what they can provide is a environmental benefit to those coastal streams. You could have a BMP at your house that you could use that rainwater. For example, it doesn't significantly reduce the flows, but it makes some of that water usable, a rain barrel system. So,
Yeah. So just quickly to answer your question on the how does this fit into the one water concept, the one water and making storm water potentially part of the drinking water, a potable water source, it's not a one-size-fits-all. So coming into this and seeing the extent of the city's existing stormwater infrastructure and to some of the points that Rob mentioned regarding the system overlying the groundwater basin and everything else, we're able to quickly look at it and say it's not going to be cost-effective to try to collect the stormwater, take it to a location where we can have it percolate into the groundwater basin. It just isn't very feasible. You take a city like LA that has very sophisticated stormwater infrastructure, then they have the opportunity to, where they were trying to just simply take water from the city and get it out to the ocean as quickly as possible, based on their situation, to say, okay, well, we have different stormwater retention basins, and we could redirect flow to different locations. Then stormwater can now become part of the kind of the bigger picture. For the city of Morro Bay, it's not necessarily an option.
So just kind of looking at the street I live on, which is Las Vegas on the north side, my garage is maybe 6 inches, maybe 5 inches above the existing pavement. But we also have about probably pretty close to 3%, some places 4% slope on that street. So the water is going to head down and just blow past. So So if I know 100-year storm's coming up, I'm probably going to have to go get some sandbags and protect myself. Is that the kind of sort of thing you're thinking
of? We're not saying that the whole city is going to be. It's only in those areas specifically identified in the stormwater model that would experience ponding in excess of 1 foot.
Well, I'm talking ponding in excess of 4 inches would probably be a real pain in the butt for me. So I haven't ever seen any water get anywhere close to that.
You're likely in an area that's not subject to flooding. An area subject to flooding that's identified in the water model as being deficient would be, a foot above it. It sounds like your situation wouldn't see any flooding.
Well, Main Street there, I guess it floods out every so often, but not everywhere.
Comment on the flooding. There was a reservoir up above the park, up on the hill that Chevron had. Have they abandoned that reservoir up there?
I'm not sure. That would be in the county, outside the city limits.
Yeah. Is this No Name Creek?
Yeah. It's all the way up at the top. And then, of course, I noticed there's a lot of brush and bushes growing in the path down through and underneath 101, underneath Highway 1, that probably need to be cleaned out because it's difficult. And we get a 100-year storm, that's probably going to bury the park there without doing that. And especially if that reservoir at the top is abandoned, then the water is just going to flow down through there, I would imagine.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that reservoir functioned in the system, whether it was in on-channel reservoir or whether it was off-channel and spilled into there. I would guess that it was probably a stock pond.
Or it could have been containment for the tanks. Yeah. I don't know.
Sure, that's a good point. Just a bit of a preview in terms of we come back with the improvements in the CIP. For the most part, the improvements aren't, build a bunch of stormwater retention basins throughout the city to try to hold the water back. It's mostly improvements to the pipe network and some improvements to street drainage that you're going to see when we come back. The water supply evaluation. So it would take a bit of a turn here to the water supply portion. So this is, technically part of the water supply the water master plan, but really we're dealing with the supply, not the distribution infrastructure. So what we did with the water supply evaluation is we first start with developing the demand projection. So that was something that we did both for the water master planning side to look at the distribution system as well as figuring out the water resource piece, is we want to know how much water the city needs in the future. We identified a suite of different alternatives. There's a total of 6 alternatives with a number of different sub-alternatives. So at the end of the day, I think there's 10 to 12 alternatives, and we'll go through all of those. We developed a pretty robust evaluation process that consisted of a number of different criteria that we used to screen the alternatives, and then a methodology that we would use to evaluate the different alternatives. We went through the evaluation, and there's 2 components of that. One is cost. Important one is always cost. In terms of the cost per acre foot of the water that we would be that the city would be supplying. And then we looked at a host of qualitative criteria. Again, one of the reasons why the city council decided to undertake this project had to do with improving the reliability and sustainability of the current water supply. And so those types of qualitative criteria also factored into the scoring of the different alternatives. We then looked and said, and this is just a bit of a preview, but there's not really one water resource that the city has access to that's going to provide all of its demand in the future, meaning that the city state water, even at 1,300 acre feet per year, while that would theoretically, if the city received its full allocation, has more than enough water, it could have 100% state water right now. However, the future demand projections exceed that 1,300 acre feet. So at some point in the future, with the city's existing state water allocation, even if you got all of it, the city would still need additional water to be able to come out whole at the end of the year. So we had to combine a couple different alternatives together, and we'll get into that to really get what the water supply pictures would look like for the city. So what could you actually do in the future with different combinations? And then we put together the report chapters that are in there. So as I mentioned previously, the city receives state water. Allocation is 1,313 acre feet per year. The other water supplies that the city has access to are 2 different groundwater basins, one in the Moro Valley and one in the Choro Valley, and then Ocean Desal. The Ocean Desal facility is permitted at a total of 645 acre feet per year. The figure here, and you'll see it in your report, is shows the state water infrastructure that serves the city of Moro Bay. There's a little bit of a blow up of the Choro Valley pipeline, the Polonio Pass pump station, and the treatment plant there at Polonio Pass.
I got a question on the state water, Rob. Do we still have the option to opt out of the state water if they build those pipes through the Delta and the cost gets crazy?
No.
No.
And I think DWR has determined that they don't need our permission to charge us for that extra cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll get to that. We went through a pretty exhaustive analysis of I can't say I did. Somebody that works for me did a very exhaustive analysis of the current cost of state water and projections of future cost of state water. Other agencies are very interested in the cost of state water, mainly agencies in Southern California that essentially use half of the total state water allocation. When you talk about a $17 billion project, it has big implications for them. So we'll go through a little bit of that and how that's going to impact future state water costs. But that's a good question. But again, DWR will subject its contractors to the cost of any improvements. Here's a map of the current treatment facilities. You can see this square here shows the current wastewater treatment plant, the courtyard, and the wastewater treatment plant. This is the FEMA flood map showing these facilities in the flood zone. The reason why I bring this up is for different alternatives where we've identified the need for additional water treatment infrastructure. We've cited that water treatment infrastructure in areas outside of the flood zone. So the city essentially has a water treatment plant that's split into 2 different portions. One is the brackish water RO system, which is what the city uses to treat the water that comes out of the Moro groundwater basin that has nitrate levels in excess of the state requirements for the state levels for the contaminant levels. So it has to go through this process before it can go into the distribution system. We did a pretty exhaustive analysis. Our desalinization expert for the company came and did a day-long analysis of the Brackishwater RO system, and some of his findings are here. In the final report, there'll be a pretty exhaustive analysis in the appendix of that report on his findings, but generally in good condition on the Brackishwater RO side. A little bit different story on the city seawater side. So again, the city has a permit to treat 645 acre feet a year of seawater. It's really a facility that hasn't been operated in 20 years. It's got some aged infrastructure, and we have some serious concerns with being able to operate that facility. If it were to operate, it would need some pretty major upgrades. And so when we go through the water supply alternatives, the desal alternative is not flipping a switch and turning on the desal plant. It's essentially replacing the ocean water desal facility that's currently at the existing site there at the Corp Yard. So we'll go through that as we get to a breakdown or a summary of the different alternatives.
So at this point in time, the seawater desalinization system does not work. Is
correct.
That a safe bet?
Oh, okay.
That is correct.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
A little background on the Morrow Well Field. It has a permitted yield of 581 acre feet. TDS has seasonally been about over 1,000 milligrams per liter, and nitrate has been somewhere around 220 milligrams per liter. On the Choro Well Field, permitted capacity is over 1,100 acre feet per year, but there's a stipulation in the city's permit that the city can't use water from the Choro Well Field unless Choro Creek is running at 1.4 CFS. So there's a minimum stream flow requirement there to be able to access the Choro Well Field. And unfortunately, when the city most needs water, when the water demands are the highest, is in the peak times during the summer, when you're less likely to be able to meet that 1.4 CFS of stream flow in Choro Creek. So there's been a number of reports that have been done by hydrogeologists looking at the availability of water in the Choro Well Field based on this 1.4 CFS requirement. We referenced that a number of different times in the report, and we'll get to one of the water supply alternatives is built on trying to augment flow in Choro Creek. It also has issues with nitrates, and TDS there, or salinity, is not as big of an issue. It's more of a nitrate issue there in Choro Creek. Again, the ocean desal facility, it's really taking water that's somewhere between 31,000 milligrams per liter of TDS. So it is maybe not a traditional desal facility. It's more of a brackish water desal facility. It's a mixture of onshore brackish water and seawater. And really, it's only permitted to be used in emergencies currently. Again, it hasn't been operated. The city would not have the opportunity to operate that facility if it needed to on a moment's notice.
In the book, you mentioned, while it is not anticipated that the facility will be operated, removal of the wells could impact the city's existing desalinization permit. How?
That's one of the things that... one of the recommendations that we made, and one of the things that city staff had heard with some of the folks from the state board, we make the recommendation in the report to for the city not to invest a lot of money in continuing to maintain that infrastructure. But I think that the goal would be to just do enough or not do too much that the city would put its permit in jeopardy theoretically. So. That's the, you know, while we don't recommend, and I'll skip ahead a little bit, while we don't recommend that the city build a new ocean desal facility and use that existing permit, it would be maybe a good idea to hold on to that permit because of the difficulty it may have in the future. If you wanted to go get a permit for desal, it would be difficult to do that. So that's kind of where we're trying to ride that line between we're saying it's not a great option for the city. Don't invest a lot of money into it versus completely walk away from it at the risk of losing the permit that you currently have.
So a major overhaul, it's really not worth it, but of course to get a baseline budget to maintain it you know, to meet the current permit requirement for emergency basis or anything else is still.
Yeah, it's really when we're talking about, we don't want to remove the wells or shut the wells down. We want to kind of mothball the wells. That's that's the way that we're thinking.
So we know it has its limitations, you know, but we still want to keep it as active as possible to meet all the requirements for future use or emergency use.
Just so the state board doesn't take the permit.
Yeah, through discussions with the water board, they actually suggested if we wanted to maintain, instead of pulling those wells out and abandoning them, just making them non-functional, actually disconnecting the power so we can't actually physically operate the wells. That would get us out of the testing requirements and maintaining them essentially at that time. But they're still physically there, and we still physically have that infrastructure. So come a day 20, 30 years down the road, if we actually want to explore desal again, we would have basically wells still basically in the ground, you know, non-functional, so we don't have that annual operating expense of testing and keeping them functional. They actually suggested making them non-functional.
Thank you.
Here's a breakdown of the historical water supply picture for the city. And as you can see, the orange that's kind of dominating there, and you can see the state water started in 1997, but the orange is state water. So especially over the last several years, the city has primarily used, to the tune of, I believe it's upwards of 85% of its total supply has come from state water, with the remainder being made up with water from the Moore well field that's treated by the city's existing brackish water system.
I'm going to ask, before you leave the water supply projections, you brought up something tonight, and I think I've heard it once or twice before. It sounds like we're not able to get out of our state water allocation in the next 20, 30 years. Is that a safe bet to say? I mean, is this something that it's been told you cannot leave? Because I'm sitting there looking at myself and saying, why would you chase any more money trying to recycle water you're not going to be able to use because you still have to buy the state water? I'm missing something here, and that's the biggest part of this for me is, or either scaling back, if you do, you know, do the indirect potable reuse and you do pump, there is a shortfall here looking at your historical projections. You're going to have to come up with, it looks like a couple hundred acre feet or something like that a year. But this treatment plant is going to put out a ton more than that. It's up around, what is it, about 800 or 900?
About 800 acre feet per year.
That's the part I'm missing. You know, there's a disconnect because when we started this whole process, and I've been on the RFCAC since the beginning, it was discussed as though you could walk away from state water, and now I'm hearing that's a non-option. And I guess that's what I'd like to get clear in my own mind as I go forward, at least making recommendations. I'm not a decision maker, and I realize that. But that's the part, that's like the $64 or $64,000 question I'm trying to sort through my mind. Is it, in fact, we cannot get out of state water? Rob sounded like it is, and we can't. I believe him. It's not that I don't believe what you're saying. What I'm trying to figure out is, why do we keep taking the course of full steam ahead and trying to recycle the most water we can? Because there is a cost involved in it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I understand that a lot of this money from WIFI and everybody else is predicated on us recycling water. So then the next issue comes, is there another purveyor out there you could sell your water to? You know, because I hate to say it, it's going to cost you more to make it than what you're going to sell it for. I could tell you this right. You know, this doesn't take a genius. But at least you'd recoup some of the cost of what you're trying to do. And I'm sorry, that's the part that's bothering me and all, you know, in all of this. I think this is a well-written report, Eric. I really do. I read through it. I didn't get through Chapter 7 as well as I would have liked it. Other things came up on my plate. But, you know, I think that's the question that needs to be asked. This is rhetorical. I'm not asking for an answer tonight or anything else, but I think it's something that you guys really got to think about is...
It's a great point, yeah.
Where are we going?
But to his point, in the 20-year horizon in the plan, is there ever room for evaluation with the state in that time frame?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to sort through.
Weren't we given a number, you know, at first it was somewhere in the 20s that we would be able to opt out, but then something like 2035 we would be able to opt out after certain payments have been made?
The one interpretation of our existing state water contract that former city attorney made was that we could opt out once the local facility bonds were retired.
That's what I remember.
2021, 22. I can't remember that date. The current city attorney's office reread not only the local contract but the master contract that is tied back to, and made the determination in concurrence with county staff. We're a subcontractor to the county. We don't contract directly to DWR for state water. We contract to the county. Is 2038 is when that contract is up. The DWR has a few things up in the air in addition to the California water fix. One of them is whether they'll allow the contractors to trade or market their allocations. That's a very restrictive factor right now. We can turn back water, send water back to the turnback pool to sell to other agencies, but we pay whatever it is, $1,500 an acre
foot.
Yeah,
close to somewhere, you'll call it $1,500
an acre. Call it $1,500 an acre foot. The maximum price that you can get from the turnback pool is $12 an acre foot. Yeah. And MWD waits until nobody buys it out of the turnback pool. The turnback pool reduces to $6 an acre foot, and then they buy it all. Because they have reservoirs in Southern California that they can pump water to. I think in my professional opinion, we don't need a one-legged stool of water supply. We need options for water supply. The California Water Project is an interruptible water supply.
Correct.
We need to have backup in...
But not to cover the entire amount of water that we use in a year. Well, I guess what I'm looking at is I could still see a use for pumping the Moro well basin and still probably injecting water for that purpose, but maybe not on the scale and scope of trying to cover 1,300 acre feet a year. Yeah. That's what I'm driving.
Yeah, and if...
I could look at that first year. Was it 1997? It looks like you got little to none from state water. I'm not sure if that was because of drought or why it's so low that one particular.
It was just coming online.
That's when state water came online.
So the rest of them are more representative sample of how much they might cut you down through drought years or through good years, as I see them. And so at the most, I'm seeing one where it's about 200 or 300 acre feet that you'd only need to try to cover in order to, you know, meet the shortfall.
Now, the city's been lucky over the course of having state water that they've been relatively whole, and it's not necessarily because of the drought conditions. It's the situation that the city is in, being a subcontractor to San Luis Obispo County that has much more allocation than what it has subscribed. And so that could change potentially.
If the city got into a battle, though, it'd be with SLO County, not with the water agency, correct?
Yes. So SLO County has a 25,000 acre foot a year allocation for state water. They have subscribed users for about 9,000.
Somewhere less than 10
acre feet a year. So they can make up the difference with the remaining part of that 25,000 acre feet. That will be debated at the County Board of Supervisors, because the countywide taxpayers pay for that excess allocation, even if they're not getting a drop of state water. It's in everybody's property tax bill that they're paying for state water, whether they get a drop or not. There are some folks that would like to see the county get rid of that excess allocation and not have it on the property tax bill. that would leave us with no drought buffer to allow us to be made whole from that. That is an issue that we will have to deal with in the next few years.
Well, the only reason I even bring it up is I see right now the county's going through it with Paso Robles groundwater basin, the issues they're having mm-hmm. up there. And it's kind of funny because we're going to be sitting there generating more water than we could use at a high cost. And nobody was willing to want to buy it, at least for the rates that the DWR or whoever it is buys it back for. I don't know. Is it CCWA or DWR? I'm not sure who it is.
So the turnback pool goes back to the state of California, and they get the $12 or $6 an acre foot. Because that's really what the wet water costs.
Yeah.
The majority of the costs in our bill is not the delivery costs or the water costs. It's retiring the debt on the infrastructure that constructed the Coastal Branch, the Chorro Valley Pipeline, the Polonio Pass Water Treatment Plant, right. and all the pump stations to get it over here.
Yeah,
I don't want to hold up.
No. It's a good point that you're making. I think it all comes down to diversification and reliability. And the city finds itself in a very good position right now, specifically with the situation with state water as it has been. And even on paper, things look really good when you start looking at previous urban water management plans and you see that the city has this big groundwater resource. Okay, well, that groundwater has contamination issues. You see it has a desal facility at 650 acre feet per year. Well, that desal facility can't really operate right now. It has state water at 1,300 acre feet at full allocation, but what happens if the situation at the county changes and or we have a drought and the allocation is 5%.
Well, then that begs the question, will like WIFIA provide loans for if you're only partially reusing, you know, doing the IPR for a portion of the plant as mm-hmm. opposed to all of it?
Yeah, the plan is not to reuse every drop of water that comes out of the out of the treatment plant. So the preliminary hydrogeological studies have identified about 825 acre feet that we're using right now.
Because the water you're going to put into the IPR has got to be highly treated.
Correct.
What goes through the outfall through the brine outfall doesn't
not as highly treated.
Treated. And I guess that's what I'm trying mm-hmm. to look at in my mind. Should we be scaling down certain aspects of this to try mm-hmm. and meet the shortfall? If we know we're kind of stuck in staying with state water,
sure.
And that's all I'm trying to bring
sure,
up.
That's
I'm
a good
sorry
point.
I took this.
No. That's a good point. So this is kind of the historical where the city has been. Now we'll talk about a little bit about the water demand projections. Again, we talk about the planning horizon that we're looking at is 2040. Population of 12,150 is what's in the city's current general plan update that they're working on. And we find ourselves in a bit of a situation here in the last few years about looking forward and how we project future water demand. And so we're coming off a period with historic water conservation and historically low water usage. And so we've looked at a couple of different scenarios. So we know, and we already know from what we've seen this last year in terms of when we've come out of a drought, what the response is, and conservation is definitely reducing, and we're seeing water demands increase. So we've got to try to look in a crystal ball and figure out what future demands are going to look like. And so that's why you see a bit of a break here with these are our projections, and then you see this is historical water usage kind of coming down here. And at some point in time, that's going to equalize and come back to maybe a new normal is the way I like to think about it is once we're never going to go and rip out all the low flow fixtures and everything else that we're putting into new homes and into existing homes, and current practices aren't going to change that much. And so we've had to take our best guess in terms of where we're going to actualize in the future. And that's somewhere around 106 gallons per capita day. At the very low, the city's been down to about 87 gallons per capita day, and at the very high, it's been at about 116. So we've picked something in the middle in order to project out the demands.
And I think that capita demand needs a bit of explanation. It's not single-family demand. it's a proxy for the entire city, so it includes commercial flows, mm-hmm. and it's used for planning purposes. So this is not what your average residence uses,
correct.
Which is much lower than that. Right. It also includes the blended water use of the entire community.
Yeah. We take the total amount that the total amount the city served over a given year, and in the denominator we have the total population, and we get it down to a number of people, which is something that we can more easily project into the future.
And
so,
it's
yeah,
only
right,
for
it's a
planning
proxy.
Purpose.
It's for planning purposes, yeah. So where we see ourselves going is an increase to about that 1,445 acre feet per year is the number that we've used in all of the different evaluations that we've done as kind of the future water demand. As I mentioned, we did a big look at the cost of state water, which, as was mentioned previously with the California water fix, everybody's concerned about what that's going to do to the cost of state water. The timing of this project was actually, we're very fortunate that that Metropolitan Water District in Southern California in February of this year it was actually doing a big look into what was the impact of the California water fix at that time, which was a $17 billion project. What was it going to mean to their subcontractors, them as a contractor and their subcontractors? And it was interesting to note, and you'll see here, this is kind of where we think the cost of state water could go in the future with the different things that are planned. And so there's a couple different milestones that I want to point out here. One is you see a relatively high unit cost in of state water in 2015. So the important thing to note is that the majority of the cost of the city pays for state water is fixed. So I don't want to speak out of school here without the numbers in front of me, but even if the city doesn't take a drop of water, they still have to pay on any given year because they don't take the allocation. They still have to pay the lion's share of the total cost of state water because most of it is in the debt service and everything else. So again, that's one thing to note. So as Rob mentioned, there's a couple of things that we're looking at here. In 2023, a portion of the state infrastructure bond is going to be retired, and so that's why we've projected we're going to see this blip in terms of the downturn in the unit cost of state water. Again, what we're projecting out is all based on full allocation essentially. We again, things rise with inflation. The cost of state water has been going up on a pretty constant basis. The O&M portion goes up based on inflation. And then there's also another debt retirement in that 2035 that we've been discussing that's going to also bring down the cost of state water. So when we look at it over about a 50-year or about a 40-year time period that we're looking at, the cost of state water will stay relatively constant, even given the cost of the California water fix. The one reason is that when the Metropolitan Water District did this evaluation of what they think the impact of this California water fix is going to be, the tunnels, the impact on individuals is actually going to be less than for individuals here that are served by the Chorro Valley Pipeline. Because the Chorro Valley Pipeline was so expensive and it was spread under a fairly small number of people, the impact or the per-person impact, cost impact of the Chorro Valley Pipeline was felt more by people here in this area than what people are going to feel from the California water fix, because the Chorro Valley Pipeline is only spread over folks in San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties, whereas the California water fix is going to be shared by all the state water contractors.
Well, on your graph there, let's say 2044, you're around 2,000 an acre foot. On that line, blue line. And my question is that 2,000 in today's dollars, or is that actually you're paying 2,000 in future
dollars? I believe that's 2,000 in future dollars.
Oh, okay. So you're saying it'd be cheaper then than it is now.
It works out in today's dollars to be relatively constant. Yeah.
In today's dollars. Oh.
What's the frequency that the state evaluates the unit cost? I mean, are they able to come back every year?
Comes back every year, yeah.
Every year.
How do impacts like what the cost of the Oroville Dam repairs, is that going to be in any of these calculations? So I know that's relatively new, and the numbers.
I don't think it's in that calculation.
Yeah, we didn't include it
but
in this.
But that cost will be passed on to all State Water customers.
Yep.
But it'll be amortized over the life of the contract. So
which contract?
The 2038 contract. Okay. So. I think the county told us they project it somewhere between $25 and $50 an acre foot of an increase.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember how much the Oroville project is projected to cost, but in perspective, the California Water Fix is now I think it's increased to $19 billion because we're looking at a phased project, one tunnel at a time. But this analysis was based on $16.9 billion. So, but you've got. Again, I'm trying to remember the exact percentage of the total amount of water that state water serves. Morro Bay gets a fraction of 1% of that total.
I think it's something like 250 million acre feet a year is what's provided by the State Water Project, and we take 1,313 acre feet a year. Yeah. So it's a tiny, tiny amount.
But also kind of on it's called the road to independence. I mean, right here, we're showing off the milestones of the debt retirement. But, obviously, the further we go out, that's an aging system. And mm-hmm. So, obviously, they're going to have some retrofits and some upgrades that it could go the other way, that they could hit us, in that same horizon.
Yeah. And the California Water Fix is only – and, again, something to note about – I don't want to get too much into the California Water Fix, but – again, the purpose of that California Water Fix is not necessarily to make state water more reliable. It's there to maintain the existing reliability of state water. So overall, the reliability of state water over the history has been about 60%. So 60% of your allocation. Again, Morro Bay is a little bit different because they're a subcontractor and because of the unique situation of Slo County. But the state is not spending $17 billion in order to increase the reliability from 60% to 70%. They're spending $17 billion to keep the reliability at 60%. So as you mentioned, there's going to be the next Oroville, the next California Water Fix. All these things come up, and the city is subject to pay for those things. So that was state water, and so we've got a good baseline. So where the city kind of sits right now, again, these are all the water supply alternatives that we looked at, and I'll break them down into a couple of different categories. A lot of them have kind of their subcategories. The first one is state water, kind of stands on its own. The other ones look at maximizing the use of the city's existing groundwater infrastructure between either the Morro groundwater basin or both the Morro and Choro groundwater basins. The third group of projects, as you remember, the Choro groundwater basin is subject to the minimum stream flow requirement that we discussed. What if the new treatment plant treated water to a certain level and put water into Choro Creek in order to artificially maintain that 1.4 CFS to be able to more frequently use that Choro groundwater basin? So another option that was looked at. The third group or fourth grouping is the IPR, or the potable reuse project. The city's current potable reuse project is sitting in this grouping here, and then we've got five is ocean desalinization, and then we looked at direct potable reuse, which we'll get into some of the regulatory implications of direct potable reuse when we get there, and the likelihood of that being an option for the city of Morro Bay. Again, we looked at a number of different water supply criteria, a total of nine different criteria. These are the general categories here. There was five criteria. Criteria categories and a total of nine criteria. So the process that we went through is we first looked at all of the costs that we looked at. It was not just capital cost, but it was capital and long-term O&M. And we developed a total life cycle cost based on a present value analysis. We developed a percentage weight for each of the individual evaluation criteria, some of these nine different evaluation criteria. We did a quantitative ranking of the five evaluation criteria, and then we applied this weighting factor to develop an overall score for each alternative. Now, one of the things that that we did back in February of this year is a survey was sent to members of your board, members of the city council, and city staff also weighed in. We wanted to have some public participation in the process of determining or weighting the different evaluation criteria. So this letter was sent out. It was actually November of last year. This survey was sent out. We aggregated the results of the survey to come up with weighting criteria for the different criteria that we used. Here's a summary of those weighting criteria, or the weights for the different criteria. As you'll see, they don't fluctuate too much. The results we got were kind of all over the board, but we normalized them, and you can see that there's different ones that are more important than others. But again, not a huge fluctuation. We had a relatively decent sample size. Again, this is probably something that's going to be a little bit difficult to see here, but you have it in your packet as well. Here's kind of the summary of the analysis. A couple of the very important things we want to know about each of these alternatives is how much can it actually supply. So a good thing to look at is alternative 2A and 2B. We're only relying on the city's existing groundwater permit for the Morro Basin. Again, it's capped at 581 acre feet. So that's something to note. Again, the other thing to look at here is desalinization. The city's existing permit is only for 645 acre feet. So there's a fundamental limitation there. You couldn't just go and say the city's going to go and get a new desal permit for 1,400 acre feet and serve all of its demand from desalination. So that's what we looked at. Again, the other important thing is we normalize to unit cost. Again, because something might be pretty cost effective from a total cost, but it's only supplying a couple hundred of acre feet. So it's important to look at it on a unit cost basis. And then another important thing, and one of the reasons why the city again undertook this project, was looking at local supply offset. So supplementing supply that's taken from Northern California with supply that can be homegrown supply, things that originate here in the city. Drought resiliency is also a criteria that we looked at, is how susceptible are these different alternatives to the impacts of drought. And then on the far right side is this weighted scoring criteria for the qualitative criteria that we looked at. I'll run through the alternatives here quickly. So state water, its historical reliability has been 60%. Again, we've talked a little bit about the unique situation that the city has as a subcontractor to the San Luis Obispo County Flood Control District. Again, we did the cost analysis, and even with the California Water Fix, for retirement of debt, we're looking at a relatively constant cost over the planning horizon. Again, it's vulnerable to drought and other unplanned outages, and by unplanned outages, we mean, and the city's has experienced this firsthand, is unplanned shutdowns for maintenance or a seismic event or something like that could potentially take out the state water system, and the city would be without state water for an extended period of time. Again, one of the limitations that we discussed is limited opportunity for exchange. The only opportunity right now is the turn back pool, and it's not very lucrative for the city to do that. Alternative 2A would include includes taking water either from the Morro groundwater basin or the Morro Anchoro groundwater basins and treating it for different constituents or contaminants in order to put it into the city's distribution system. Things to note here, Choro, again, is subject to that minimum stream flow. The city is an appropriate of water right holder for both of these permits, so they have a very low priority water right. Based on what upstream users are doing, or they're subject to the whim of some upstream users. And again, there's water quality concerns in both of these basins as it relates to both salinity and nitrate. 3A, which folks probably have heard a little bit about, is the stream flow augmentation option. Again, taking the wastewater from the new wastewater treatment plant to a fairly high level, not as high as it would need to go for potable reuse, and then putting it into Choro Creek, augmenting that stream flow, and then being able to utilize the water from the Choro groundwater basin. One of the things that's noted here is this commitment to stream discharge. So City of San Luis Obispo is in a bit of a unique situation. They discharge their wastewater to San Luis Obispo Creek. They've wanted to reduce the amount of water they discharge to San Luis Obispo Creek to produce more recycled water, but because of habitat creation and other things, they've had to keep that water in San Luis Obispo Creek. So one of the things that we think about when we talk about discharging wastewater to an inland surface water is, it can limit you to doing something else with your wastewater resource in the future if you want to do that. The alternative four grouping is the indirect potable reuse. Again, this is the project that the city is moving forward with currently as the WRF project. It's taking water, treating it to a high level. Right around 845 acre feet is what's been identified in the Morro groundwater basin to mitigate any kind of seawater intrusion. So there's a fundamental cap where you can pump. Again, we have ongoing studies that we're undertaking to figure out what that number is going to be. One thing to note is it's fairly comparable to desalination in terms of cost. So it's interesting to note that of all the alternatives that we looked at, there's really two that are the most resilient to drought, and that is desalination and potable reuse. Again, and both of those kind of came out at a very similar cost. So a number of questions have been asked about the WRF project. Well, why don't we just use the desalination facility? And the answer to that would be it's essentially the same cost when you factor in everything that goes into a new desal facility and the advanced treatment facilities for potable reuse. Again, desalination. There's permitting challenges. The city's existing permit is based on emergency operation, and the regional board has said that they would like to see an alternative outfall location identified and permitted if the city wanted to use the desalination facility on a permanent basis or a routine basis. So something to think about. Again, it's a drought-resistant supply, but it would require some significant amount of work or essentially construction of a new desal facility. The other is direct potable reuse. So again, we had to kind of look into our crystal ball as the state doesn't have regulations finalized for direct potable reuse. There's a number of different types of quote-unquote direct potable reuse or potable reuse that looks different than what the city's currently looking at. So best guess is there will be some type of regulations finalized in 2023.
Eric, on this particular one, I'm sorry, the last line says similar cost to indirect potable reuse, but back on that cost comparisons, it was almost like $700-$800 cheaper. DPR versus the IPR. I'm sorry, I read it wrong. The salinity, 4B versus 6.
Yeah.
I was just kind of surprised.
Yeah.
You're comparing it to not doing the salinity removal.
Yeah, just the 4A, potable reuse with any kind of, okay. Without any kind of post-treatment is on par with direct potable reuse. The way to think about that is we're essentially trading out the cost of additional treatment on the direct potable reuse side with the cost of the injection infrastructure on the IPR side. So as I mentioned previously, none of these individual alternatives on their own would supply the total would be able to supply that total 1,445 acre feet that the city is going to need at build out. So there would need to be some kind of combinations of options that we've put together. And as you can see on this chart, we show all the different alternatives and what the makeup would be. So one example would be for the potable reuse alternatives. At the end of the day, for the base potable reuse option, the 4A, about 65% of the total water supply would come from potable reuse. The other 35% would potentially come from state water. Other options would be, or the one option the city does have to supply all of its own water if it decided to do this would be using the Choro and Morro groundwater basins to their highest, to as much as they could possibly use. Again, the total permitted capacity for both of those basins together is about 1,500 acre feet, so it just meets the city's total requirement. So what we've done here is the cost changed slightly because we have an aggregate of a couple different alternatives together. And so these are listed in the order of most resilient to drought, so drought resiliency, which is, again, one of the driving forces for development of this plan. And as you can see here, we start off with the highest is about 90%, with a couple of the IPR alternatives that would utilize some kind of treatment on the back end where we're not concerned about inducing some amount of seawater intrusion, would allow us to potentially extract more water from the basin. And you can see here as you go down how it's how they're identified. I'm sorry, this is ranked based on cost. You can see the cost per acre foot. Sorry about that. The next one is different. One thing to note is for two of these alternatives, actually three of these alternatives, you can see here 2C, 2E, and 2E, or 2D. We have to consider the cost per acre foot of these different alternatives, both with Choro, Choro Creek, which are taking water from the Choro groundwater basin, and alternatives where we're not taking water from the Choro groundwater basin because of not meeting minimum stream flow. So we look at it and we say, okay, all this, we have all the sunk capital cost in the infrastructure to be able to treat water from both of those groundwater basins, but if we can't meet the minimum stream flow, then we can't take water from Choro Creek. And so we have the same numerator, essentially, but the denominator changes based on the amount of water that we can actually utilize. And so those look to be fairly inexpensive options, but when you take into account the reliability of the Choro Basin, those numbers change a little bit.
And again, on the minimum flow rate for when we can pump and treat it, does that have to be gauged daily to understand when we can take that? And in the last few years, I mean, out of 365 days, I mean, when have we been able to achieve that flow rate?
There was a study that was done back in, I think it was back in 2014, that looked at a historical, fairly historical record when there was some stream, when the city's been monitoring the stream flow, and it was about 45% of the time. I think it was looking at about a 7-year time period, and about 45% of the time, the stream did not meet the 1.4 CFS.
Currently, we monitor the stream flow about every 2 weeks. The permit requirement is continuous monitoring.
Rob, you had said that if we were injecting into Choro Creek, whatever we injected into Choro Creek, we could take out. Is that not accurate?
Whatever we inject into the groundwater basin, we can remove. If we discharge into Choro Creek, likely we wouldn't be able to remove that water.
So, in other words, we would have to do some groundwater injection in order to have the right to take the water back out.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, you're kind of riding the line here between a couple of different alternatives. The way that we structured the alternative 3A and 3B is that the city would be discharging water to Choro Creek as a disposal method. And it's a little bit of it is semantics, where we're telling the regional board, hey, we want to discharge water to Choro Creek as a disposal method versus sending it all the way back to the ocean. The side benefit of that is being able to meet that minimum stream flow. But if we were to say, well, we want to discharge water, and so we're subject to the limitations of the 1,100 acre feet that we could take out of Choro. Going the other way, if we told the regional board and said, we want to discharge to Choro Creek to get recharge, then they would say, okay, well, if you're doing that, that's a whole different set of regulations and a whole other set of treatment requirements, more stringent treatment requirements. But then we would have the ability to pull more water from Choro Creek potentially. So one of the reasons, and I'll skip ahead here a little bit, one of the reasons why originally we thought the alternative 3A and or 3B was pretty attractive was because it has a relatively low unit cost, but we started looking into some of the implications of discharging to that creek, some of the regulatory and permitting implications. That's what really took that alternative out of the running and gave us a lot of pause moving forward on an alternative like that. So, again, now these are ranked in order of no longer no longer cost, but due to based on drought resiliency, again, one of the key criteria that we looked at. And you can see the Choro streamflow augmentation is good because essentially when you're able to put water into Choro, you should be able to meet that 1.4 CFS at all times. And so you could take water from that basin at all times, and it makes up a significant portion of that total 1,400 acre feet. Again, the RPR alternatives, the ones with treatment where we would potentially be able to extract even more water, are ranking up there high. The alternatives that we've been zeroing in on here, this 4A, is about an 80% drought resiliency as compared to state water, which is quite a bit lower. At the 46% is actually the lowest.
I'm confused on that one because 4A versus 4C, they're both IPR.
Correct.
Why does one have a higher drought resilience?
It has to do with some of the previous hydrogeo studies that have been done that say you put so much water into the basin, but once you start to extract it at different rates, you could start to create water quality issues.
Oh.
And so if you have treatment after you extract the water, you may not be as concerned with the water quality issues because you're treating it again. So
you're saying you fall into 4C if you're pumping too much water.
Exactly.
Oh, okay, gotcha. I don't want to tie you up any longer than we need to.
So looking at these general categories, we came up with, this is just kind of a summary of a high level, some of the pros and cons of these different alternatives as it pertained to some of the key criteria that we look at when we look at implementation of a water supply project. Again, drought resiliency is of utmost importance, and local supply offset. Those were two of the most important driving factors that were used to start this project. Again, unit cost is important. We always look at cost as part of the picture. And then permitting challenges are also important. Again, things like state water, there is no permitting challenge. Indirect potable reuse, while permitting challenge, there's a lot of permitting steps that go into it. It's something that's been done. It's something that can easily be accomplished. Desal has its own set of permitting challenges. Direct potable reuse is in a very gray area in terms of permittability and what those regulations will actually look like. So the recommendation coming out of this report is that the city move forward with indirect potable reuse. So kind of on the heels of that recommendation, how does that impact all the other water resources that the city currently has access to? So indirect potable reuse, the recommendation here is to move forward with some of the additional hydrogeo work that the city is already planning to do to give us a better idea of exactly how much water we can inject and how much water we can extract. When state water is available, the city should use IPR as a backup. We can't escape the fact that the city is somewhat locked in, especially now, to their state water contract. And state water is relatively inexpensive, and the city is going to have to pay for it anyways, even if it doesn't take it, or at least a huge portion of the cost of state water they have to pay for. So IPR should be looked at in periods where the city is getting a large amount of its allocation as a backup, as a backup supply. And really, the focus should be on injecting that water into the Morro Basin on a consistent basis. Some previous hydrogeology studies have identified that there could be some flushing of the nitrates in the groundwater basin. So by injecting, there could be a benefit to diluting and flushing the nitrate concentrations in the basin, such that you wouldn't have to do any post-treatment. So that's the recommendation there. In terms of state water, again, it's the lowest cost supply alternative. It should be maximized in the short term. The one thing that the city does do is it purchases a drought buffer currently.
Is that a yearly payment? Is it like an insurance policy, or
yep.
do you only pay it in the years you actually use the drought buffer?
No, it's like an insurance policy. We pay it.
So you could physically let that go.
We can let that. There's no restriction.
Well, at least
on
now we're getting a little money back.
Yeah,
what I'm trying to do is try to make this thing work.
Yeah, the city pays into it now, and there's some in terms of water fix and other things that could increase the cost of that drought buffer. So again, IPR becomes the city's drought buffer.
Oh, okay.
And then the other thing is just to continue to work with San Luis Obispo County and monitor what's going on with DWR to find exchange opportunities. Again, there's other folks in the region, in the Paso Robles region. They need water. Facilitating ways to be able to exchange could be something that the city would want to participate in the future. Ocean desal, as Joe alluded to earlier, we want to try to maintain the city's existing desal permit and not walk away from that because it could be difficult to get a new discharge or a new desal permit. So we want to again ride that line between not doing too much where we lose the permit, but we also don't want to we don't want the city to invest a lot of money in trying to maintain that infrastructure that right now isn't really doing anything. And then the Choro groundwater basin. This is another example of a water resource the city has put a lot of money into on an annual basis and doesn't see a lot of benefit right now. So the recommendation here, again, it's the lowest. It's essentially the lowest priority potential source that the city currently has. Based on discussions with staff, the city spends about $40,000 a year maintaining infrastructure in the basin. Between the stream flow reading and maintenance of the existing wells, it's about $40,000 a year. Also, to secure the water right in Choro, the city needs to construct a couple of stream flow gauges. The cost of those stream flow gauges weren't included in some of those Choro Valley options. It's a project the city has started, and it's kind of on hold right now. But the recommendation would be to not move forward with the construction of those stream flow gauges at this time, and then really to discontinue its existing activities in the Choro Basin.
Would the city be able to maintain its, if it had to develop that water source, would it be able to maintain those right-of-ways if they discontinued activities?
So we received a permit in late 90s for Choro and Moro. And we have 30 years to make beneficial use of that water. We would have a difficult time making beneficial use of the water in the Choro Valley.
One question on the cost of the IPR. I think you had around $2,300 or whatever it was an acre foot. It doesn't matter. Whatever the number was. I assume that includes the capital cost of building the system as well as the operation and maintenance, correct?
That's correct. We looked at a 30-year net present value.
I was wondering at some point if you could break out the two, because at the end of the day, you're still going to have to build the IPR system regardless of whether you make one drop of water or you make a thousand acre feet. Because to me, I'm looking at it as you might want to use it to its full resources and maybe look at some of these other towns that may not want to do a drought buffer either, and you give them the water from your base flows in that year, trade it off with other towns around here that are tied into the same system. I'm just trying to come up with a way where this makes sense, and that's the part that concerns me.
Yeah, there should be a breakdown in the report of capital versus
I didn't
O&M,
read chapter 7. It might be in there.
Yeah, it should be.
And if I stand remiss. I'm sorry.
That's okay. If that granularity isn't in there, the detailed cost estimate breakdowns with all the line items will be included in the.
Yeah,
in
it'd be interesting to see, because I don't know if it's only costing you $300, for the O&M after you already bought the system.
That's
cheap water.
So I read chapter 7. And I noticed in there that there was a lot that the desal or the reverse osmosis plant was going to be suggested that it be moved to another location. Mm-hmm. Is this included in this cost when you were talking about the increased water cost with the wharf? The $16 that's supposed to go for the water cost.
So the option 4A is the option where we don't need to do any treatment. Again, that's the option where we're looking at the flushing of the groundwater basin and only extracting to a level that we don't start to create additional water quality concerns. So the 4A is essentially what's included in this existing rates that have been identified. The city also has the ability to use its existing treatment facility when the wharf goes online, it does need to do treatment for a period of time. But if the city needed to build a new treatment plant, that's what's included in these costs.
So it's included in that cost that, am I getting the right answer, asking the right question? The proposed suggested cost of this new wharf is including $41
Correct.
Maybe surcharge, $25 for sewer and $16 for water. Does that $16 for water, is that, that's what I'm asking, is that what's going to be used to pay for building this new plant that has to be, if it has to be moved?
No, that's not included in that $41. Again, we don't think it's likely that we're going to have to build a new plant. And that's what we're looking at, and what the new hydrogeology work is going to tell us is how much water we can extract so that we don't need to do treatment on the back end. And that's what we're going to size the facility for.
But also the existing one is in this floodplain,
mm-hmm.
which will the Coastal Commission have anything to say about it staying there?
If the city doesn't plan to rebuild it, then right now the facility can stay in its current location. It's in good condition. It continue to operate that facility.
You're talking the brackish
system. Talking about the brackish water RO facility, yeah.
You're recommending the desal system go away, as I...
Essentially to mothball the desal system on the ocean side. Yeah.
Inactivate.
Correct, yes. Correct.
Well, thank you. That sounds like you've come to an end here. Do we have any other final questions or comments that can be answered?
Real quickly, I thought it was a well-read document. I did not finish it. However, it reads well. I appreciate the work that's gone into this. I really do. But I think the city has to come to terms with, if they're going to generate this water, you know, how do we dispose of it, so to speak, short of letting it go out through the outfall? And that's the part that concerns me right now. It really does. Because it sounds like we're tied at the hip with state water through the next 20, 30 years. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions? Or?
I don't see any.
All right.
Thank you very
Thank
much
you.
For the presentation. Rob.
And if anybody has any comments that they want to submit after this, please email them to Damaris, and she'll accumulate those and make sure that they get looked at and incorporated into the report as necessary.
When will this be going to the City Council?
It's going October 9th to the City Council. We may try to think about this. I have a joint meeting with City Council, so you can view the final report with the City Council.
So you'll have the final report for that meeting?
We'll have the chapters that aren't completed yet included in that document.
And when you're talking about the joint meeting, that would be the October 9th meeting?
October 9th. It is already scheduled for an early start at 4:30, so it would likely be 4:30 to 6.
Okay, so that would be a separate meeting from the
regular
session. Okay. Let's see. You'll let us know if that will be
That's correct.
A joint meeting.
We would do a quorum check Call. Before yeah. we would schedule that.
Okay. So would we still be having our regular meeting on October 17th?
Yes.
Okay. In that case, I will let you know that I will not be available for that meeting. With the third Wednesday in November being like the day before Thanksgiving, do you see that as being a regular scheduled meeting or?
Typically not. we usually take that meeting off.
Okay. Do you see that there would be an alternative meeting date for November or just the whole month? Or at this time, it's too early to tell?
Probably a little early to tell, but we'll make sure that we have that information as quickly as we can to check with the board members to see if there is availability for a meeting in November.
Okay, and as far as December, also the 19th is the third Wednesday.
And typically we do go dark in December.
We go dark.
Okay, so just wanted to check some of that for the future calendar. So I will not be here next time, or at least on the 17th. So if there's no other questions or comments, then we will stand adjourned to whenever our next meeting is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe the night.
That'd be correct.